TV with Cam Edwards.
Good Monday to you. Thanks so much for tuning in to another edition of Cam and Company right here on NRA TV, Sirius XM Patriot 125, Apple, Amazon, and more. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Coming to you once again from beautiful downtown Farmville, Virginia today. We've got a jam-packed show. Carrie Pickett is going to join us on the ground from Santa Fe, Texas. We'll talk with her coming up in just about 20 minutes or so. Also later in the hour, Rick Ector of Rick's Fire Academy of Detroit will be with us over the weekend in Taylor, Michigan. Rick hosting the 7th annual event, inviting women out to the range. And just giving them free firearms instruction. Rick hoping for 800 attendees one day in Taylor, Michigan. Now, when we talked with Rick, this was early part of last week. They had 700 women who had signed up. They had space for, again, about 800. Not just Rick, but a host of volunteer firearms instructors. Out at the range, we'll find out from Rick how it went later on in the hour. Next hour, join us on the program, Charles Cook of National Review, writing at National Review, says Senator Chris Murphy from Connecticut demonstrates why gun control advocates are mistrusted. Also, Michael Graham of the Boston Herald joins us next hour. A piece at CBS News, the problem with quote-unquote common sense gun laws. Also, in hour three, Tim Lee with the Center for Individual Freedom joins us. And Glenn Reynolds, the blogger behind Instapundit.com, a law professor at the University of Tennessee in Knoxville and a columnist for USA Today, his latest column, How Can We Inoculate Ourselves Against School Shootings Like What We Saw in Santa Fe, Texas on Friday. Glenn says, we've got a problem, and it has to do with memes. He says, not the photos of cats or the American Chopper guys with, you know, amusing text superimposed, real memes. He says geneticist Richard Dawkins coined the term meme to describe self-replicating information that passes from one person's mind to another. Genes, he points out, are self-replicating information, and so are memes. Memes are ideas that infect someone who then spreads that idea to others. He says memes can be about anything. Some can even be benign and even beneficial. Others, he says, are dangerous and can ruin or even end the lives of those infected by them or the victims of those who are infected. And Glenn writes about whether or not we are seeing the memification of this type of violence. An individual walking into a school intent on causing as much harm and destruction as possible. And whether that idea, again, is replicating. Glenn says the idea is not exactly new. It's been more than a decade since Lauren Coleman published The Copycat Effect, How the Media and Popular Culture Trigger the Mayhem in Tomorrow's Headlines. He says it was back in 2015 when Malcolm Gladwell likened the spread of school shootings to a slow motion riot in which each new participant takes cues from predecessors, almost like following a script. Glenn wonders, how do you contain a contagion? He says, well, you try to protect people from infection. You try to quarantine the infectious and vaccinate the unexposed to increase their resistance. So what does that look like in 21st century America? We'll talk with Glenn Reynolds about that coming up in hour three. Also coming up in hour three this afternoon, we have today's hero of the day. We have our deal of the day. We have our good guy as well. We've got all of the day's top Second Amendment news and information from across the country. Including news out of Washington State, where lawmakers are pushing for a special session to deal with school safety. Senator John Braun said the key is going to be focusing on legislation that can actually pass rather than gun control measures. He says that no law or legislative action will alone change human hearts and altogether stop violence, but the legislature can take steps to reduce the risk of deadly school violence, which stems most often, he says, from mental illness. We'll also be covering news out of California this afternoon. Another attempt to ban gun shows at the Cal Palace just outside of San Francisco in Daly City. And we've also got news for you out of New England as well, where with an eye towards the midterm elections, some lawmakers are staying mum when it comes to the issue of gun control. But I want to start today with our coverage from Santa Fe, Texas. Again, Carrie Pickett is going to join us from Santa Fe here in just a few minutes. She's been on the ground over the weekend doing lots of interviews, talking with folks there in the community, as well as some of the officials that were there. We've got a bit of a press conference held over the weekend with Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick, who was also speaking on Friday at the press conference that we brought you live here on Cam and Company. And I want you to take a look and a listen to the press conference held again over the weekend with Texas Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick.
We have devalued life in this country. We throw God out of school. We have 50 million abortions. We have families that are broken apart, no fathers at home. We have incredible, heinous violence as a game, 2 hours a day in front of their eyes. And we stand here and we wonder why that this happens to certain students, and then the mental health issue that plays in a part of this. I said this morning on an interview, this is not about guns, and the smart things we can do about background checks and other issues we'll address and we'll do. This is about us as a culture and a nation. Who are we? Who are we as a people? That we just accept that our kids learn how to kill people and every day on the games. And that industry, by the way, the video game industry, larger revenues than movies, larger revenues than music. And nothing about it. When Obama was president, the motion picture industry wrote an open letter to Joe Biden saying, do not interfere with the content of our movies. Ethan Hawke, the actor, said, you know, the actors talk a lot about being anti-gun, but we all make more money when we have violence in our movies. Look, this is, there are lots of pillars to this issue that created this situation and others. It just didn't happen yesterday. And so, and the responsibility of gun owners who have guns at home, lock your guns up. In Texas, we have a law. If a child finds a loaded gun, you'll be responsible. We don't know all the facts of how, maybe this young man broke into a gun safe. I don't know how he got his guns. He shouldn't have had the guns. So, look, anyone trying to find one issue, this is multifaceted. But it speaks to who we are. I sometimes think about a student in a classroom. You know, I went to a pro-life event several years ago at Texas A&M, and a young lady, I said, why is this group pro-life event here on the campus? And she said, because we're the first generation who realizes our parents didn't have to have us. I never thought of that when I grew up. And so how does that student in the classroom, if he feels like his own life was that fragile, and then he sees the family, the fathers who have left, so if his own life is fragile, if no one seems to care about him, if there's no moral foundation, why does he then value that life of that student next to him? What suddenly he's supposed to in his own moral compass, find the right way when there's no one to teach him? So, and then there's evil in the world. That's always going to be a part of it. The last thing I'll say is I talked the other day about, in the press conference, about hardening these targets. Look at this school. Lots of entrances and exits. And, you know, and I was very sad to see for political reasons. So, well, you can't limit exits. You know, there could be a fire. Of course we have exits. You bring in the fire marshal, they tell you the exits. But no one should be able to come in those doors. No one should be able to get in the teacher's door. There should be one or two entrances at most, and we should have law enforcement looking at those entrances. We had two armed officers here. What if he had to go through an entrance where, as the Israelis do, the Israelis have the three Ds, and that is deter, detect, and deny. Maybe he would have been deterred. Maybe he would have been detected. And surely had they detected him, as they proved with their bravery, they would have denied it. And maybe these 10 people would be alive today. So we have to harden our, you know, the average school in America is 44 years old. They weren't built for this. So we can do this, sensible, and limit the access. And people say, well, how are you going to get 1,400 kids in school all at 7:30 in the morning? Well, maybe we have to maybe have an extra hour study hall in the morning. They can use it. And maybe we stagger the entrance for poor students. Some come at 7:30 and 7:45. In other words, everything ought to be on the table. And I applaud the governor for having these roundtables because everything will be on the table.
Are you thinking about calling maybe in a special session down the road after?
We'll have the roundtables. And look, we're going to be in session before we know it. And I can assure you that whatever the answers we find from the experts, and from citizens and from parents and all those involved, it will be Senate Bill 1. Whatever that is, that will be Senate Bill 1. It'll be our first priority.
Would you like to see charges against the father? You brought up an interesting point.
Well, I don't have the facts. That's up to the prosecutor. So, I mean, I don't know. I don't know the facts there. And is this, 70-year-old, you're considered an adult here. So that's for the prosecutor to decide, not for me. I don't know the facts of that. But I'm just saying that I'm a gun owner. Many of you are gun owners. We have a responsibility to be sure our guns are safe at home. That's where gun control starts, at home. Let's make sure no kid gets his hands on a gun or someone breaks into your home and gets your gun. Your guns ought to be safe at home. So, look, thank you all. And thank you. Let me tell you what. When we find the answers, the money's not going to be the problem, I assure you. The money's not going to be the problem. We have the money in this country and we have the money in this state to do what's right. And now maybe finally people will act. But as soon as you talk about hardening the schools and making them, people are, oh, no, that won't work. All these naysayers, if you don't want to participate in a discussion where we can find the right answers, then maybe you don't want to participate. But we have to find answers, and we have to arm our teachers. I went to Clear Lake Hospital the other day, and every parent I met there, every student who was in the room with this one student that was shot, we said, Governor Abbott asked them, what do you think we should do? And to a person, they said, we need to arm the teachers. If another person has a gun, the best way to stop that person is with another person with a gun. But an even better way is four people with a gun to stop that person. We cannot have soft targets. Anyone with a gun needs to know there are teachers in there that are trained and armed, and there's law enforcement in there, and I'm not going to make it past the door. That will be some of the most concrete things we can do early. Look, again, I get to ask the question all the time by some of the presses from out of this area. We already have a law in Texas that allows teachers to carry. Take a training course, how to handle active shooters, but we leave it to the superintendent, the school board, and the parents to decide. It's a local decision, and I think a lot of them will be reviewing that. Thank you all for being here.
Again, that Lieutenant Governor of Texas, Dan Patrick, addressing reporters over the weekend, and I did see a news item over the weekend that mentioned that back in November, the Santa Fe, Texas school board did vote to adopt armed school staff, similar to what 170-plus districts in Texas have now adopted. But they did not have time to put that plan in place. Again, typically what happens after a school board votes to do this, whether it's Texas or another state, you then work with your local law enforcement to come up with the training requirements. You get your volunteers, you vet those volunteers, you get them trained. And it was anticipated that this was going to be in place for the start of the next school year. On tomorrow's Cam and Company, we're going to talk with Tim Bulot from Strategic Weapons Academy in Ennis, Texas, a law enforcement officer in the Lone Star State who has been training educators. They opened up what was supposed to just be one course free of charge for any educator who was interested. And that course filled up so quickly that they soon added a second course. Now Tim is going back. They'll be doing more beginner-level courses, but they'll also be teaching some intermediate courses this summer. And we're going to talk with Tim Bulot about that coming up on tomorrow's Cam and Company. I do want to take a time out. When we come back, Carrie Pickett is going to join us from NRA TV. She is down in Santa Fe, Texas, has been there all weekend talking to members of the community, again, talking with officials there, and we'll get a report on the ground from Carrie. Then later in the hour, Rick Echter of Rick's Firearm Academy of Detroit will be with us on the program. Next hour, Charles Cook of National Review, Michael Graham, writing at CBS News. So stick around. We have a lot more Cam and Company straight ahead.
I'm here with Scott Doherty with BronxBox. Scott, welcome to the program. How are you?
Thank you. Very good.
So I've been walking around the show, and I keep seeing this box, and it's got a lot of neat stuff going on, so I want to stop by and talk to you about it. What is BronxBox?
BronxBox is made in Coldwater, Ohio, American-made. It is a containment system, modular. You have a system up top that you can mount weapons, computer gear, or any configuration of what you want to put in it. On the top here, also, you can do modular system on the bottom with foam for guns, magazines, and equipment. It's roto-molded, so it's It's filled with foam, so to withstand temperatures, and you could also use that as a cooler. It has wheels. It has four different handles. It has eight different ways to lock it down. Compression locks, military grade. Four different ways to lock it, two in the front, cable in the back. Also, you can strap it. You can strap it in the front, and also has a saddle system. Over here, we also have another system. That's all with weapons. This is with weapons and gear for the tactical teams. Put your weapons up top. You put your gear on the bottom. It comes with a divider and a tray. And then it also has wheels. It's TSA approved, the pressure relief valve, and you pull it in like your luggage.
So what are the lights for inside?
The lights for, say a SWAT team gets called in the morning. They click their lights on to get dressed, get all their gear on, ready to go. When they come back, if it's still dark, lights, click the light on, put all your gear back in, it's ready to go.
How do we get more information?
Go to bronkbox.com.
Bronkbox.com. Scott with Bronkbox, thank you so much for showing this great product. Thanks for what you do. Thanks for being on the program.
Thank you, sir.
All America lies at the end of the wilderness road, and our past is not a dead past, but still lives in us. Our forefathers had civilization inside themselves, the wild and outside. We live in the civilization they created, but within us, the wilderness still lingers. What they dreamed, we live. And what they lived, we dream. Every animal that has ever roamed this planet was designed as hunted or hunter, predator or prey. We are hunters. If it were ever necessary, even the strictest vegan would return to the wild, driven to survive by the instincts of his ancestors. Those who hide behind the soft delusion of their own ignorance do so from within a civilization whose very being costs the lives of countless creatures every single day. Death is an undeniable fuel of life. This is the undeniable truth of existence. To live in balance with the planet that sustains us, we must admit and embrace the nature within us. Trust the hunter in your blood.
Welcome back to Cam and Company. Thank you again for being a part of the program today. Still to come on the program about an hour from now, Charles Cook of National Review joins us as Senator Chris Murphy of Connecticut demonstrates why gun control advocates are mistrusted. In the hours after news broke on Friday about the shooting at Santa Fe High School in Santa Fe, Texas, there is Senator Murphy tweeting out blaming Congress for the lack of passage of gun control laws. As Charles Cook points out, not a single proposal that Senator Chris Murphy has been supporting there in Congress, had it been in place, would have prevented this attack. So Charles, again, demonstrating and pointing out some of the reasons why gun control advocates like Senator Murphy are mistrusted, not only by a lot of gun owners in this country, but by some non-gun owners, too. Now, I want to bring in right now, live from Santa Fe, Texas, NRA TV correspondent Kerry Pickett, who has been on the ground over this weekend talking to members of the community and officials as well. We just heard a little bit from Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick. And, Kerry, thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks, Cam. Well, it's very interesting what we have out here. I'm standing outside of Santa Fe High School with a lot of other media. And just earlier, we had a moment of silence at around 10 a.m. local time. A lot of officials, a number of students came here to have prayer circles, to really find some healing, try to find some sort of a logic, which is very difficult to find, of course, in, at this time, but ultimately to really band together after this horrible, tragic event, Cam. But ultimately, there's going to be a lot of that going on in the days to come. In the meantime, Governor Abbott is going to be having these roundtable discussions starting tomorrow, talking about mental health, talking about hardening of the schools. But that's not going to be without some controversy with the Houston Police Chief, Art Acevedo, who has already weighed in saying that he's looking for some more gun control measures. But, of course, the Lieutenant Governor has already countered that, saying that that's just not time for that right now.
Yeah, it's interesting, and I've seen some of the national reporting, Carrie, reporters who aren't necessarily local to Santa Fe, Texas, like yourself, who've come in, and many of the folks who I have to assume are at least moderately anti-gun, they seem somewhat surprised and perhaps a little disappointed that we're not hearing more talk from the community itself about the need for gun control. I saw a story over the weekend about several church services where, again, the message was about healing. It was about love, but it wasn't demanding gun bans. And there's almost, again, this sense of I get disappointment from some of these reporters that, that gun control is not more front and center right now as a topic of discussion there in the community, which, again, as you point out, is a community that had a moment of silence today. This is a community that is grieving, that is mourning. And it sounds like many individuals there in Santa Fe aren't interested in playing politics right now.
Excellent point there, Cam. What's interesting here is that the demographics here in Santa Fe, Texas, are very, very different than what we saw out in Broward County, Florida. While they experienced a very, very similar, if not almost exact, situation, nevertheless, the reaction has been almost a 180 in terms of political activism. In fact, what we're seeing here is a community that really just wants to grieve and wants to pray and doesn't really want to talk politics, doesn't want to talk about legislation. I understand that a Moms Demand organizing group got together about an hour north from here because it didn't seem like there was anything materializing directly here in Santa Fe. And as far as that group was concerned, nothing really came of it as far as what I know right now. But that doesn't mean, Cam, that local officials here and that local residents here aren't concerned necessarily that something could come up in the next few days or weeks, because ultimately people may want to lay low and let the people grieve here and then try and find some individuals who may be susceptible to perhaps some talking about when it comes to gun control advocacy. But let's just wait and see.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, again, as you say, moment of silence earlier today. We know that some of the victims, including the school resource officer who engaged that attack, are still hospitalized. And you know, the media is there to get their story, but the community, they're there again. They're grieving. They're mourning. They are trying to find a way to carry on. You have graduation season, which is coming up. I know that the Santa Fe baseball team, high school baseball team, played over the weekend and saw some very moving pictures there. And so it does seem like the community itself, I mean, it's almost like living in a fishbowl at this point for the members of the community that are trying to carry on and then doing so in the shadow of this omnipresent media presence, which has invaded their town.
That's right. And what we're also seeing, too, as far as outsiders are concerned, keep in mind that there are a lot of outsiders who come in who have had a similar experience. I know that there was an individual who came in who lost a child in the Aurora shooting and said, look, I don't have any political, agenda. I just want to tell these individuals who lost a children that there's someone here to help them get through it. There's someone here to help them heal. And I, as far as I'm concerned, I just want to help them get through the process. And that's what I think that this community is really looking for right now.
Absolutely. Well, listen, Carrie, I appreciate you joining us from Santa Fe. We will let you get back to work. But thank you so much for your time, and we look forward to talking to you again very soon.
Sure thing.
Kerry Pickett there on the ground in Santa Fe, Texas. And again, we're going to have much more throughout the afternoon right here on Cam & Company, including news that we did not know on Friday when we were on the air here, and that would be the names and identities of those who were murdered on Friday. And so I want to take a moment to talk about those victims because, again, one of the sad parts of the media environment that we live in is that there's going to be far more attention focused on the perpetrator of this crime than on those innocents whose lives were taken on Friday. Cynthia Tisdale was a substitute teacher at Santa Fe High School, the grandmother of 11, 64 years of age, and she was there, engaged as a substitute teacher in part to help raise money for her husband's battle with lung cancer. Christopher Stone, 17 years of age, was murdered on Friday as well. Glenda Ann Perkins, faculty member there at Santa Fe High School. Jared Black, who was one of the victims as well, a nickname of Spyro, according to the BBC. Sabika Sheikh, who was laid to rest over the weekend, a foreign exchange student from Pakistan. Angelique Ramirez, a 15-year-old student at Santa Fe High School. Christian Riley Garcia, known as Riley, eulogized by the pastor of his church in Texas, who wrote on Facebook, "You are greatly loved and greatly missed." Shanna Fisher turned 16 just 10 days before the attack. Her aunt, Erica Fisher Harris, on Facebook wrote, "My beautiful niece has gone to heaven with her classmates. Life was not supposed to end like this for our sweet girl." Kimberly Jessica Vaughn was one of the victims as well. Aaron Kyle McLeod, one of the victims murdered there in Santa Fe, Texas. And we are, again, continuing to monitor those who are still hospitalized, including the school resource officer, Officer Barnes, who at last report, still in critical condition, a 23-year veteran of the Houston Police Department who had begun working there in the Santa Fe Independent School District, part of their school resource officers just a few years ago. And we keep him and the entire community there in Santa Fe, Texas, in our thoughts and in our prayers. And we will again try to bring you the latest information throughout the afternoon there from Santa Fe, Texas, as well as continuing the conversation with folks like Charles Cook, Michael Graham, Glenn Reynolds from Instapundit as well. I do want to get to a couple of other stories here while we have the time to do so. I mentioned earlier, a couple of minutes ago, that we've got another attempt out in California to ban gun shows from the Cow Palace, which is the big convention center just south of San Francisco in Daly City. Specifically, there is one gun show that is held there at the Cow Palace. It's held multiple times a year. It's the Crossroads of the West gun show. And we've seen a similar move down in San Diego to try to get the fair board, because it's held at the local fairgrounds, to rescind its contract with the Crossroads of the West gun show. Well, in the Bay Area, you've got local lawmakers who are set to introduce legislation. State Senator Scott Wiener of San Francisco now proposing legislation that would ban the sale of firearms and ammunition there at the Cow Palace. Now, keep in mind, this is California, so every gun show in California, you're actually not walking out with a firearm because of California's waiting period. So even though you can purchase a firearm there, you can't actually pick it up and take it with you. You have to wait for the entirety of California's waiting period before you can take possession of that firearm. Every California gun control law applies at every gun show there at the Cow Palace. But Senator Wiener says, "I'm hopeful that we will be able to persuade the governor that this is a good idea." He says that he has, quote, "nearly universal local support from communities surrounding the Cow Palace," and he said that he hopes to ride the wave of, quote, "an amazing outpouring of student activism around the country against gun violence and in favor of gun safety measures." This is according to the San Francisco Chronicle. He and his co-author, Assemblyman Phil Ting, Democrat from San Francisco, announced their effort Monday at the Bayshore Community Center there in Daly City, where the Cow Palace is located. Planning to be there and support, according to the San Francisco Chronicle, 16-year-old Erica Cardoza, who helped lead a demonstration at her campus there in Daly City, Jefferson High School, back in March. She says she supports the Second Amendment right to bear arms, but she says, quote, it should be a privilege to own a gun, not just willy-nilly, like you can have whatever you want. It needs to be responsible. We have regulations for cars. Why can't we have regulations on guns? And, again, every gun show there at the Cow Palace in Daly City falls under California law, and they're not just regulations. These are actual laws governing the sale of firearms and ammunition, laws that have become more restrictive over the last few years. Well, not just the last few years, but increasingly more restrictive since 1998 or so in California with the passage of the state's first, quote-unquote, assault weapons ban. In recent years, we have seen a number of gun control measures passed via referendum in the state of California, including a third redefining of the term assault weapon. They've actually gone back and changed this three different times in California over the last 20 years, as well as new laws that will limit the sale, actually end the sale of online ammunition purchases, now require individuals in California to have basically an ammo ID card that they can use for their in-person ammunition purchases. Ammunition vendors who are not FFLs, not federally licensed firearm retailers, also now have to have a special license in order to sell ammunition. That is, again, across the entirety of California, including there at the Crossroads of the West Gun Show when it takes place at the Cow Palace. As the San Francisco Chronicle points out, efforts to end gun shows at the Cow Palace have failed three times before in the state legislature, although in 2013 they did get a bill to Governor Jerry Brown, who vetoed a measure by then-State Senator Mark Leno from San Francisco that would have required local county authorities to authorize gun shows, and the local authorities there would not have authorized gun shows. So it would have been a ban in all practical terms, even if it was not technically a ban on paper. Senator Wiener says the Cow Palace is important, and I'm not critical of the Cow Palace. They have to be financially sustainable, he says, but we have to balance that with our core values. And in the Bay Area, people overwhelmingly do not support gun shows. So, again, even though all California laws apply there at the Crossroads of the West Gun Show when it takes place at the Cow Palace, the senator says we just don't like them, and so therefore we should ban them, which is interesting because the Bay Area historically has been known as a place of tolerance and openness and acceptance, and you be you and let your freak flag fly, and that's all good. And now they're talking about banning things. According to the San Francisco Chronicle, Robert Templeton, who is the co-owner of the Crossroads of the West Gun Shows, says that each of the failed legislative efforts in the past to ban those gun shows have been misdirected. He says the current one is no better. Rather than focusing on reducing the proximity and number of firearms, he said we need to keep the guns out of the hands of criminals, people who are too mentally ill to own them, people who commit domestic violence. He says we have common ground on both sides. He says we all want to see this horrific gun violence stopped. We agree there. But, he says, in order to have a dialogue, we'll have to be much less polarized than we are now. He says this recent senseless spate of school shootings has energized the people who would like to take away our gun rights, but he says we need to deal instead with the people who perpetrate violence and the potential perpetrators. And again, buried in like paragraph 14 of this story, the San Francisco Chronicle, you learn, quote, nobody can just buy a gun and walk away with it. Yeah, purchasers must undergo a 10-day waiting period and a background check and then pick up the weapon from an authorized dealer. Assemblyman Ting rebuffed the reassurances, according to the San Francisco Chronicle, saying that local objections to the gun shows should trump other considerations. Yeah, you know, I mean, again, go back in San Francisco's history, there would have been a time right around the, before the rise of the Haight-Ashbury counterculture. Go back to the early 50s. Go back to the beatniks that started to settle in and around San Francisco. The opening of City Lights Bookstore, Allen Ginsberg's Howl, which would have been banned by many in San Francisco at the time, and was attempted to be banned by communities across the country, a poem, because they didn't like it. And there in San Francisco, again, you probably would have had at that point in the 1950s a majority of residents who would have said, yeah, we're not real cool with this either. But they didn't ban it. And the City Lights bookstore was a beacon for openness and tolerance and progressive attitudes for decades to come, as San Francisco itself became a beacon of openness and tolerance. And again, do your own thing. Now, Assemblyman Ting says that gun shows at the Cow Palace are, quote, the antithesis of what San Francisco and the Bay Area stand for. Huh. Because, again, I thought that the values of the Bay Area would have included people exercising their constitutionally protected rights, but maybe those days are at an end. All right, when we come back after a quick timeout here on Cam and Company, Rick Hector of Rick's Farm Academy of Detroit is going to join us over the weekend in Taylor, Michigan. Seventh year in a row that Rick has hosted this event, and it started out, I don't want to say kind of small, but comparatively speaking, kind of small. I think the first go-round 7 years ago, Rick had like 50 individuals, all of them women, who showed up at the range to get free firearms training. This past weekend, they were hoping for 800 women to show up there in Taylor, Michigan for their free firearms training. So how did it go? We'll get an update from Rick right after this. Stick around. There's much more Cam and Company on the way.
Speaking with Paul Spitali, he is Senior Vice President at Colt Manufacturing. Let's talk about Colt's involvement in the Bianchi Cup. It's the 40th Bianchi Cup. So let's start right there. First of all, welcome. And why is it so important to Colt to be part of this competition?
Well, I can tell you, and thanks so much. It's a huge honor for Colt. I mean, we've had more than three decades of support of this event. It's a national championship and sponsored by the NRA, which we're huge supporters of. And for us, the Bianchi Cup has become kind of like the Super Bowl of the action shooting sports. And for us to be affiliated with it for this many number of years, it's humbling. But it's also a really special event when you see all these competitors, not only competitors that you see year in, year out nationally, but even teams from Australia and other parts of the world that come to it. It's just it's a tremendous operation that the NRA puts on in Columbia, Missouri, and we're just really, you know, thankful and proud to be a part of it.
And Paul, you say Columbia, and I get a smile on my face because I've been to many a Bianchi covering it for first NRA News. Now we're NRA TV, and I love it out there. Let's try it. Help me out, Paul. You've been to probably more of these than I have.
Yeah.
Give people an idea what happens at Bianchi Cup.
Well, the beauty is they put shooters through an incredible, you know, rigorous discipline of different stages, whether it's plates, there's barricade stages, there's stages where they're in prone positions, they're shooting movers that are moving across from right to left and left to right. It's incredibly difficult. And when you consider people like Doug Koenig, who's also a friend and somebody who has won this thing, I think, 18 times and counting now.
Wow.
When you see someone like that shoot a perfect score, which is 192 targets hit, and then had X counts as high as 185, I think his record is 188 X's for an event. That's an incredible over a 3 or 4 day shoot to have that level of proficiency. So, you know, when you see that level, and he's not the only one who shot perfect scores. There's, you know, Bruce Pyatt and many of the other nationally ranked shooters. But it's really great to see that kind of that level of expertise at that level. You just don't see it in everyday life.
Speaking with Paul Spitali, Senior Vice President at Colt Manufacturing. So, Paul, you're there at Bianchi in supporting the event. It's a great event. It's, as you said, it's like the Super Bowl of action pistol. It's a great way to describe it. There's just an energy there at this facility when it's happening. Just all these teams and guys going through and gals, and there's young folks, old folks, just, and it's a great spirit of camaraderie. Cause I was going to joke, is there any kind of trash talking? But that really doesn't happen at these kind of things.
Well, you know, that's one of the things I mentioned. I gave a speech last year to the folks there, and one of the interesting things about Bianchi is even though they're fighting really difficult circumstances and competing at such a high level, they'll be the first ones to drop out of a stage and help a competitor or a team has a problem with a particular gun, and they're helping right there to help out. And I saw it time and time again. The other thing that I think is extraordinary about the Yankee Cup is when you look at the volunteers, these people that devote, you know, they don't get recognition. They're not getting medals or trophies or pictures, but they're there really because of their love of the shooting sports and what has been created over now 40 years, this wonderful national championship environment. And I just think it's a real celebration of the Second Amendment. It's a celebration of these really highfalutin, you know, professional shooters, but it's really just something that you just rarely see in this society, and we're glad to be a part of it.
That's awesome. Talking with Paul Spitali once again, Senior Vice President, Colt Manufacturing. They're going to be part of Bianchi Cup, and it's coming up soon, right? It's, I think, starts on the 23rd of May,
yeah,
correct?
Yeah, comes over that weekend, and, you know, we have a long-standing support of our military, and we honor them. But here is a special weekend where we honor, you know, people who have served in this in our reserves and served in acts of duty and veterans. And here's an opportunity during that special weekend to give them thanks. You know, Colt's been supporting our military to, you know, long before even the Civil War. So we're proud of that fact. And here's another chance for us to demonstrate and support that through that special weekend that we're a part of.
And, Paul, how do we get more information about Colt?
Yeah, the best way is to go to Colt.com. We have wonderful information on our website, which has been repurposed recently, actually. And there's great information there.
Welcome back to Cam and Company here on NRA TV, Sirius XM Patriot 125, and much more. Cam Edwards, your host. All right, still to come on the program, Charles Cook of National Review, Michael Graham, columnist of the Boston Herald, a piece at CBS News. The problem, he says, with quote-unquote common sense gun laws. Right now, I want to welcome to the program from Rick's Farm Academy of Detroit, on Twitter at DetroitCCW, Mr. Rick Echter is with us on the program. Rick, how are you today?
Hey, man, I'm stoked. Still stoked. Every time, you know, we have our annual event, man, training the ladies, man, I'm just excited because, you know, we put another one in the books and everything turns out well.
Well, I'm glad to hear that everything went well. The weather was cooperative for you this weekend?
It wasn't picture perfect, but it didn't rain and storm. But, you know, we had so much participation and manpower from fellow firearms trainers across Metro Detroit, man, that even if it had rained cats and dogs, we still would have been able to do some business. So we're feeling really great about what we did this weekend.
I am so glad to hear that. Now, I know, you know, we talked last week before the event, Rick, and last year you all had trained about 600 women.
Right.
You had space for 800, and when we spoke to you, I think you said about 700 individuals had RSVP'd. So I got to ask you, did you make 800?
Actually, we actually got up to 850 RSVPs, and we didn't get the 800 mark. We got 700. So still stoked and excited that we moved the bar forward continuously from 600 to 700. So, you know, it gives me something to shoot for, pardon the pun, next year.
There you go. Well, you've already got 150 individuals who you know are interested, and I don't know what happened, but maybe they'll be the first in line next year. And again, Rick, 700 people over the course of one day. I mean, that just the logistics of this are amazing. So can you brag on some of those volunteers that you mentioned, those firearms instructors from the Detroit area? How many folks did you have out there helping you?
Every firearms instructor that I'm close to here in southeastern Michigan had a hand in it. You know, not only do I want to commend those guys, man, but it's people like Aguilar Ammunition that came through for us with 16,000 rounds of ammunition. The NSSF came through with, like, gun locks, man. And, you know, we had a local dealer here, Doug Holloway, that gave up the guns for us to, you know, provide them for the use of the ladies to shoot. The gun range, I mean, can't forget those guys, Top Gun, gave us their range for the full day, man. And without those guys, we couldn't even made it happen. But, you know, it took a lot of people to make this thing happen, and it was successful. You know, 700 people participated. The youngest was a 12-year-old. The oldest was 86. Zero injuries whatsoever, and 100% smiles.
That is fantastic. 12 to 86. I mean, Rick,
yes,
that's pretty amazing. And I don't know how much time you had a chance to talk with any of the individuals who came out, but I'm guessing the vast majority of the women who were there did not have a lot of experience or exposure to firearms beforehand.
No, they didn't. You know, there were some who just like to come every year, and, you know, everyone can't come every year. There was a few of those, but many of them, they were just waiting for that nudge from somewhere to make them do it. This one lady really, you know, really made an impression on me. She was like 4 or 5 years she had been mulling it, and she finally caught wind of the promo for the event, and she finally came. But, man, it was great. From 12 to 84. You know, from every demographic, they all were there, and it was 100% smiles, man. It was just a great event. And here's the even bigger thing. For the participants that volunteer their time to do this event and to work it, you know, it gives them all individually to a person a very great sense of satisfaction and a warm feeling inside, man. And you can't put a dollar on that.
Absolutely. Well, and again, I mean, the fact that you just mentioned that one individual who had been weighing for years whether or not to go. I mean, that, to me, that speaks to the importance of events like this, Rick, because we talk all the time that if you did not grow up in a gun-owning family, you don't know any gun owners yourself, maybe, there's a – it's intimidating, right? You don't want to go to the range for the first time because you're afraid what are going to people say? Are they going to laugh at me? Am I going to be the newbie? But to have an event like this where you know you're going to be far from the only person who has never, you know, picked up a firearm before, you're going to get that instruction. I just think this is an incredibly beneficial event, and it might take a couple of years for somebody to find that fortitude to say, all right, you know what, I'm going to go out and do this. But kudos for you, because as you say, you know, to conquer that fear, to conquer that fear of the unknown, such a good feeling. And the smiles on those faces, I imagine – that was just an incredible reward for you.
It was, man. And to a person that participated, male or female, who were firearms trainers, many of them that I've trained or worked with over the years, man, they all left with a great feeling inside about a job well done. And all the women that were there, that from 12 to 84 across every demographic you can think of, the gun range even told me, man, they were like, in the history of working with us in this event, you know, this is our third year working with them, this was the best year they did in terms of actually supplying, you know, them with sales. You know, people were just waiting for this event to come around, or in some cases they first heard about it for the first time and they were excited. And the thing I like about doing this is that I want my partners like the gun range, Top Gun, and Taylor to actually get something out of it too. And they left feeling good about what we all did.
Well, listen, Rick, thank you again for all of your work there and for coming on the program talking about this. I got to imagine this is probably one of the highlights of your year. How long before you start working on next year's event?
Man, actually, it's a continual effort, you know, trying to identify participants and resources and things. So it's a continual thing, and it builds up. Today, I'm actually going to start working on next year's event. This thing is not something you can just throw together. It's something you have to put a lot of planning into it, but it's a labor of love, and I enjoy doing it.
Well, listen, man, and there are so many folks out there in the Detroit area and all across the state of Michigan who benefit from that. Because I got to ask, I mean, you know, this was Taylor, Michigan, so not in Detroit proper, but fairly close to Detroit. Do you know how what's the farthest away somebody came from in order to take part in this event over the weekend?
Well, I can tell you right here, offhand, Rhonda Ezell from Chicago, the gun rights case out of Chicago, came on down and supported us. She was there, man.
Oh, that's awesome.
Glad to see her in the house. A year ago, I rode up to Chicago for a Maj Touré event, you know, that they had in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
I've been hearing about Maj and Rhonda, and you know what? if they're in Chicago and I'm in Detroit, only 4 hours away, shame on me if I don't get in the car and drive up there and go introduce myself.
Man, that's awesome. And you know, that's not the closest range to Chicago, but, you know, Roddick still to this day can't go to a range in Chicago because there aren't any. So, you know, she's been continuing to keep up her activism. I'm glad that she was out there. And sounds like this is just an amazing event. I got to get out there one of these years, Rick.
You know what? We'd be happy to have you. You know what? And I bet we could set it up where you could actually do the show from there.
We need to. All right. We got a year to plan this. As you say, this doesn't come together easily. But we'll wait for Cameron Gray to go back from vacation, John Pop to get back from his sick day, and we'll start working on the logistics of this.
Hey, man, you don't tease me. I'm excited now. I'm going to be on you guys. Like, hey, can we do this? Please, can we do this? Can we broadcast Cam and Company from the ladies' event in Detroit, man? That would be so awesome.
Well, listen, I can't make any guarantees because if I do, then John Pop's going to yell at me. But I can promise you,
right,
I will do everything I can to make that happen next year because I think that would just be absolutely tremendous. Rick, thank you so much for coming on the program, man. Thanks for all you do.
Hey, man, you are welcome, and thanks for having me again, man. Appreciate all you guys.
Always a pleasure. Rick Hector joining us from Rick's Farm Academy of Detroit. Again, on Twitter, at DetroitCCW, and a special shout-out to Katie and Justin, who are flying solo back there today. And then later in the week, Katie's going to leave. It's almost like it's summer or something, and then it's going to be Poppy and Justin hanging out in the back. So there you go. But we hope that Cameron Gray is enjoying his vacation. I've seen some pictures, and he did actually make it over there, which is good, because if he had missed the whole cruise thing and the flight delay, that would have been... would have been a very unhappy Cameron Gray, who would have been coming back a little bit early from his vacation. So I'm glad that we don't have to, I'm glad he doesn't have to go through that. And I'm glad that we don't have to go through that by association. All right, coming up on the program next hour, Mr. Charles Cook of National Review joins us. Also, Michael Graham of the Boston Herald. We had just told you a couple minutes ago about the legislation introduced in California to ban gun shows from the Cow Palace, which is a state-owned facility, just outside of San Francisco in Daly City, site of the, it was the site of a Beatles concert way back in the day. It was the site of the 1964 Republican convention in San Francisco. Yeah, I know. Try to ponder that these days, right? For, I think, 28 years, it has hosted the Crossroads of the West Gun Show. Now lawmakers, actually for the fourth time in 10 years, you've got lawmakers who are trying to put a stop to those gun shows there on state property. Meanwhile, the San Francisco Chronicle also reporting that out of the Lake Tahoe area, the Reno Gazette Journal reports the Washoe County School District has notified parents that a revised dress code has changes that no longer prohibit clothing that, quote, promotes weapons. This comes after a student, an eighth grader, ended up being involved. He wore a pro Second Amendment shirt to school. I believe it had a picture of a firearm on it. He was twice told to remove or cover up that T-shirt because it violated the dress code. His parents responded by filing a federal lawsuit claiming their son's First Amendment rights had been violated. According to the San Francisco Chronicle, the Reno Gazette Journal says the notification did not mention that lawsuit in the letter to parents. The lawsuit does remain pending at this point. And, you know, again, no real surprise if you have followed this issue for a few years, you've seen similar stories. And it never ends well for the school district. Never ends well for the school district. Because students, they don't lose their First Amendment rights when they walk through the schoolhouse door. You can go back to, was I believe the Tinker decision, Tinker versus Des Moines School District, handed down by the Supreme Court, a case dealing with black armbands worn by students during the Vietnam War. And part of the court's rationale in Tinker is that students' speech is protected as long as it's not disruptive, even if it's unpopular speech. You know, in Des Moines, Iowa, in 1967, opposing the Vietnam War by wearing black armbands probably would not have put you alongside a majority of students, certainly not faculty or the adults in the community. But the Supreme Court said that doesn't matter. It's not just that you have the right to say things that most people agree with. You have the right, even as a student, to express yourself on positions that maybe the majority of your fellow classmates or teachers, faculty, don't agree with. And as long as you're not doing it in a way that is disruptive of the learning environment, then that's constitutionally protected. So we've seen other cases around the country dealing with pro-Second Amendment shirts, NRA shirts that students have worn to school. And on those occasions where a faculty member or an administrator says, Billy or Sally, you got to take that shirt off. You got to turn it inside out. You got to wear something from the lost and found instead of that shirt. Again, it's never ended well for the school district. We've been doing Cam and Company since 2004. We've covered a fair amount of these types of stories, and I cannot recall one of them in which the school district actually won. And their dress code remained in place. The student remained suspended. Nope. It always ends with the school district backing down. Usually the threat of litigation is enough, but sometimes this stuff's actually gone to court too. But up to this point, and I guess now we've got the streak alive, our rights prevail over those who find them to be wrong. Stick around. Hour two of Cam and Company is coming up right after this.
I'm here with Joel Weens with WSI Sports. Joel, welcome back to the program. How are you, sir?
Oh, great. Thanks for having me.
Hey, we run into each other at shows like this, and I always ask you the first thing, Joel, what are you doing here?
You know, I make beautiful underwear, and someone's got to cover your undies, and that's me. I'm your guy.
And you're also a cold weather. You're from Minnesota, right?
Minnesota. We know cold.
Yeah, you guys know Cole. My wife's from Minnesota, and man, oh, man, I think it affects you for life. So, but she's always saying, wear your long underwear, wear your long johns. Like, I think I've worn long johns where I came from PA. It's just not a thing to do, but when you're out there or you're out in the field hunting or doing something else, you need to have that kind of coverage. So,
good underwear.
So give us an idea a little bit about WSI Sports. What are you all about?
Yeah, well, I started the company 27 years ago, and we're all about making products in the USA and getting great innovative products. You know, America has the best technologies in the world, and I'm just capitalizing on that. And you know, I love to see people grow and make it local.
And you go not just to, I mean, because you do stuff for a lot of sports stuff, NFL and other things like that. What was your sort of entree into, you know, a show like this where you have hunters and outdoorsmen? How did you get into that direction?
Well, it was kind of a natural, you know, gravitating to the outdoor and hunting. A lot of these consumers love the Made in USA. They love technology. We got a great resource local around Minnesota, and they need good, great cold weather products, and that's where we really have focused a lot of our energies.
So you do your real field work out in Minnesota.
Yep, get out there with our underwear on.
Do you wait, Joel, till it gets like, you know, 5 degrees with the wind chill minus 25, then you send everybody out in undies?
I love it. Now, it was 72 below. I tested some of my product at 72 below wind chill.
Wow.
And I said, hey, you know, we got the testing field right here. We got to capitalize.
72 below.
It was amazing.
Amazing. It's scary. all right. So Joel, we're here with Joel Weens with WSI Sports. Give us an idea of the line, what you guys make.
Well, a lot of it is more underwear, as we talked about, kind of base layer products. We like to basically create products that can be thinner, lighter, warmer, and we also have, you know, antimicrobial for the, you know, the no smell and stink and odor, and we'll cover you from head to toe.
So whether when you're talking about, oh, that's an important thing, whether it's a football player or someone in sports or working out, or whether you have someone, a hunter or an outdoorsman in the field, it's important. This stuff is going to be going through not only just some extreme conditions of weather, but extreme like physical conditions too.
Well, I tell you, I remember growing up as a kid, we'd go to northern Minnesota, we would walk out to our tree stand, you work up a frickin' sweat. You get up in that tree stand and sit there for 10 hours.
And you're cold.
And my dad said, you got to stay up there. And it's like, boy, I'm freezing my butt off. We got to come up with a better solution.
Yeah, and my thing I remember, before we got on the air, Joe, we were talking about socks. So that's got to be an important thing, because that's what kills me is when you're out and you got boots on, whatever, you're sweaty, and then your socks, you're wearing cotton socks, they get all wet, and the worst.
Our heater socks are amazing. One of our best sellers, because if you can keep those feet dry and warm, critical. That basically sets the tone medically, physically.
Right, yeah.
For your system.
You're right, because when you get cold like that and you're out, it sets a tone in your mind where you just cannot warm up.
That's
and
right.
It can be dangerous when you're out there doing that. So speaking with Joel Weens with
WSI
Sports.
And the term cold feet, getting cold feet.
Yeah, it ain't funny sometimes. So, Joel, how can people get more information about WSI Sports?
WSISports.com, WSISPORTS.com.
All right, WSI Sports, Joel Weens. Great stuff. Good to see you again. When you head back from the show, just stay warm out there in Minnesota for me, will
Amen.
You, please? Because I worry for you, man, all right?
Hey, we love it.
You're watching NRA TV with Cam Edwards.
Welcome back. Hour two of Cam and Company starts right now here on NRA TV. Sirius XM Patriot 125 and more. Charles Cook of National Review joins us on the program later in the hour. Michael Graham of the Boston Herald as well. Talking about, in Charles Cook's case, Senator Murphy says, demonstrates why gun control advocates are mistrusted. And to quote just a little bit from Charles' column at National Review. He starts by quoting Senator Chris Murphy of Connecticut, who had said on Twitter on Friday, in the hours after the news broke about the shooting at Santa Fe, Texas High School, quote, "Let's call it like it is. The horrifying inaction of Congress, slaughter after slaughter, has become a green light to would-be shooters who pervert silence into endorsement." In other words, Senator Chris Murphy, senator from Connecticut, says when Congress doesn't pass gun control laws, then these killers out there view that as Congress endorsing their actions. Charles Cook says this is pretty strong stuff. He also says it's kind of unclear as to what exactly Murphy's talking about. You know, again, in this case in Texas, the killer used a shotgun, a .38 caliber revolver. As Charles Cook says, because he was 17 years old, he was ineligible to purchase a gun either privately or commercially. Therefore, he had no contact with the National Instant Check System, the NICS system that Senator Murphy wants to expand. He says if his public statements are to be believed, Senator Murphy does not want to ban shotguns or .38 caliber revolvers, which is why he's made no effort to convince Congress to do so. According to Senator Murphy's website, the senator favors, quote, universal background checks, cracking down on straw purchasers and illegal weapon sales, and limiting access to high-capacity magazines and military-style assault weapons. In addition, he hopes to secure, quote, legislation to close loopholes in our background check system, to make it illegal for those on the FBI terror watch list to buy a gun, to end the ban on gun violence research at the Center for Disease Control, a ban which didn't exist in the first place, to encourage licensing requirements for handgun purchases, and to help keep guns out of the hands of domestic abusers. As Charles Cook points out, none of those provisions intersect with Friday's murders, which means, Charles says, that if, as Murphy claims, Congress is to blame for not having taken steps to stop what happened on Friday, then Senator Murphy is to blame as well. He cannot have it both ways, Charles Cook writes. If today's murders or Friday's murders were the result of congressional inaction on shotguns and revolvers, then Charles Cook says he must share in that responsibility. And if he is not responsible, Charles says, then neither is anybody else. As Charles Cook points out, Murphy chastised Congress for not acting. He says, as far as I can see, there are only two reasonable ways to interpret this behavior, that Senator Murphy is a grandstander who does not understand this issue well enough to do anything but shout, "Do something," whenever he sees an abomination in the news, or that Senator Murphy actually does want to ban shotguns and revolvers and everything else besides, and by extension, he wants to repeal the Second Amendment to the Constitution in order to get it done. Neither of these options, he says, likely to reassure his skeptics. So we're going to talk with Charles Cook about this coming up on the program later this afternoon. But I also, you know, again, I want to get beyond the typical back and forth that we have seen play out both in media old and new over the weekend. And Charles Cook is absolutely right to acknowledge that what Senator Murphy said, again, the sort of vague, vacuous calls for more gun control laws, but to not get specific because, again, to get specific, you couldn't really come up with a law that would have addressed what happened on Friday. So can we actually get beyond, then, those empty calls for gun control? Can we actually get to the heart of the matter here, which is not a simple thing and is frankly not really related to just one cause? You know, the ease with which lawmakers say we need to do something, like Senator Murphy did on Friday. We've talked about this on the program before. Look, these are lawmakers. What do lawmakers do? They make laws. And so when a lawmaker says we need to do something, that means we need to make a law. And they may be successful in making a law. And then their do something has been done. They get to sit back and say, well, I did something. I made a law. Or I did something. I wrote a bill, even if it didn't become a law. But I did something. Now, if that bill becomes a law, it's up to not the senator or the representative who sponsored that legislation to enforce the law. It's up to an entire different group of people to enforce that law or to attempt to enforce this law. This is something that we are seeing now, conflict across the country between the lawmakers who want that soundbite solution. They want that quick fix, and they want that easy legislative victory. So they can say, look, we did something. Versus the law enforcement officers who are increasingly saying, well, yeah, but what you did really doesn't do anything. You did something, but you did something that we weren't asking for and something that is unenforceable and something that really won't work. And I'll give you two examples. Most recently, Boulder, Colorado, where the Boulder City Council unanimously, 6-0, passed a gun ban. Any firearm that they would deem to be a quote-unquote assault weapon, which would include 22 caliber rimfire rifles, will be banned unless you go down to the Boulder Police Department and you get a certificate that will allow you to continue to own said firearms. Magazines over 10 rounds also banned as of later this summer. And the chief of police there in Boulder was asked about these proposals before they became law. And he acknowledged, many members of the city council actually acknowledged, it's going to be really hard to enforce these laws. We're not going door to door, he said, asking people, do you own these guns? We're not doing house to house searches for magazines. So typically, he said, when we run across somebody who would own one of these firearms or own a magazine, you know, we get a call at the range, but typically when we were to encounter somebody who would be in violation of this local ordinance, it would be in the commission of a crime. And once you're talking about arresting an individual in the commission of a violent crime and they're possessing a gun that Boulder has banned or a magazine that Boulder has banned, they're going to be facing more serious charges than a local ordinance. They're going to be facing charges again dealing with that violent crime. So are these laws likely to be used? The chief said, not really. Not going to use them. Really hard to enforce. And yet the city council went ahead with it anyway. The other example I'll mention is last year in New Mexico, to great fanfare, a quote-unquote universal background check bill was introduced. Democrats had taken control of the state Senate, and I believe they already had control of the state House at the time. But in 2016, they had taken control of the state Senate. They really felt like they could get this bill through, at least to Governor Martinez's desk, and maybe she would sign it, maybe she wouldn't, but at least they could pass it. And so they introduced this bill, which again was your standard sort of quote unquote universal background check bill. So every transfer of a firearm, not just every sale of a firearm, but every transfer of a firearm, including temporary transfers, would have to go through a federally licensed firearms dealer. So if you and your buddy, if you wanted to, you know, swap guns for a couple of weeks, so he could try out your new pistol, you could try out his new rifle, you got to go down to the FFL first. Your wife wanted to loan her rifle, hunting rifle, to a friend for a mule deer hunt. Okay, got to go through an FFL. It doesn't matter how long you might have known that person. Doesn't matter how far away from an FFL you might live. And in New Mexico, you can live quite a ways away. None of that would have mattered. You would have had to go through this in order to remain in compliance with the law. So the bill gets introduced, and it actually, there's a lot of opposition from gun owners, but there's also a lot of opposition from law enforcement. In fact, ultimately, every county sheriff in the state of New Mexico came out in opposition to the quote-unquote universal background check bill. You had the wife of a law enforcement officer who was killed in the line of duty, Albuquerque police officer, write just a scathing rebuke to the lawmakers who were trying to use her dead husband as an example of why the quote-unquote universal background check laws were needed. And his widow, by the way, is a law enforcement officer herself, a sheriff's deputy. And so she wrote about the ineffectiveness and the unenforceability of the quote-unquote universal background check law. And then she also wrote about what law enforcement officers really would like, a tool that really would not only help protect law enforcement officers, but help protect the community at large. And it was a fairly simple thing. It didn't require violating anybody's Second Amendment rights, didn't require restricting anybody's right to keep and bear arms, or even really, you know, aiming legislation at law-abiding gun owners. It was legislation aimed at criminals, people who already have a criminal record. And if you've got somebody who's a violent criminal, who commits a violent crime, make it harder for them to get out on bond. That was her suggestion. Let's do what we can when we've got people who are known threats to keep them over until their trial. And law enforcement was in favor of that. They were not in favor of, again, a plank that is now part of the standard gun control platform, quote-unquote universal background checks. And it wasn't because these county sheriffs were in the back pocket of the NRA or were kowtowing to the gun lobby. It's because they would have to enforce this law, or try to, if it actually were passed and put on the books. And as law enforcement officers, they said, okay, it's going to be really hard for us to do that. After the fact, again, if we find evidence of a crime, and as we're investigating that crime, we find that somebody, you know, didn't go through a FFL to transfer a firearm, okay, there's a charge that we could apply after the fact, but that's after the crime's been committed. So that doesn't do anything to stop the crime from being committed. And they, again, offered up suggestions and solutions that would have been really beneficial. Now, again, they weren't gun control proposals. They weren't soundbite solutions. They weren't calling for a ban on that type of firearm, or a ban on that type of magazine, or restricting the rights of law-abiding New Mexicans. That wasn't what it was about. Because law enforcement, at least the county sheriffs there, opposed to the universal background check bill in New Mexico, they knew that and know that a disproportionate amount of violent crime committed and driven by people who are well known to the community that they live in, well known to law enforcement, well known to the criminal justice system. And those repeat violent offenders, they're cycling in and out of the jail cells and the prison system there, often again, committing a violent crime, taking a plea bargain to reduce charges, doing less time than what they're eligible for, and then soon be back on the street. Sometimes again, getting released on bond and going on to commit another violent crime while out on bond. These law enforcement officers in New Mexico knew, okay, if we can focus on those individuals and we can deal with those relatively few lawbreakers, as opposed to trying to impose these unenforceable edicts on hundreds of thousands of law-abiding gun owners in New Mexico, they knew that could make a real difference. And ultimately, because of the opposition, not just from law enforcement officers, but from citizens across the state of New Mexico. That bill didn't get out of committee. Even though Democrats control the legislature and the gun control lobby really thought that that was going to be a signature legislative victory for them, they couldn't get out of committee because of the opposition. And it wasn't, well, we don't like Michael Bloomberg. And it wasn't that the entire state of New Mexico opened up their mail and found a check from the NRA inside. It was the realization, not even the realization, it was the awareness that this was an empty soundbite solution as opposed to a real substantive policy solution to the violent crime there in New Mexico. And unfortunately, you know, and we'll talk about this with Charles Cook from National Review here in just a couple of minutes, that seems to be, again, a standard part now of the back and forth in our nation's gun debate, proposing either vague calls for gun control, you don't even get serious or specific about the legislation, or proposing these soundbite solutions that allow a politician or a lawmaker to say, look, I've done something, and it passes the buck on to law enforcement to actually try to deal with these impractical and unenforceable laws. All right, so stick around. When we come back, Charles Cook of National Review joins us later in the hour, Michael Graham as well. And top of hour three, we have today's hero of the day, our deal of the day, and our good guy. Stick around. There's much more Cam and Company coming up next. We're talking with our friend Don Hillier, the owner of Hiding Hilda. It's good to see you in person, Don.
You too, Cam. Thanks for coming by.
Absolutely. It's great to see all this, the products here from Hiding Hilda. So first of all, I got to ask, where did the name Hiding Hilda come from?
So Hiding Hilda, I had a stalker for 6 years who ended up in 10 years in prison. And for 2 years, I literally hid out. And Don Hillier is my name, so Hilda was like a sign-in for work, and then hiding was literally what I was doing. So when I got trained and I decided I wasn't going to live like that, now my Glock's name's Hilda, and I'm living out loud. So I'm still hiding Hilda, but not literally hiding out myself.
I had a feeling Hilda was going to be a gun, but you know, and that's a scary story. But this is, I mean, you decided to do something positive with that horrible experience. You don't want, obviously, other women to go through what you had to go through. You
right.
want them to be empowered and be able to protect themselves.
Absolutely. Living in fear is no way to live. Watching every back. Once I finally started carrying, I had my concealed permit to be able to walk out of the house, walk in out into a parking lot, which I didn't do for a couple years by myself because of the situation. I mean, it's just, it was so empowering. I felt like a big girl again. I could handle whatever situation. I was not going to go down without a fight. And it's okay.
And so
I'll be okay.
You've got purses, you've got backpacks, you've got a vest to wear. I mean, like, how many products do you have right now?
We carry, on average, with everything about 400 products. We try to have something for everyone. So we have on-body carry, off-body carry, bullet jewelry. Women love their accessories. Like you said, the vest. We try to be fashionable and in style, but very functional. It has to work. It has to be able to be functional. So if it's not functional, we're not going to carry it.
All right. So where can folks find all of your products?
All of our products are on the internet at hidinghilda.com, as well as we travel around to a lot of the gun shows as well.
All right. Well, Don, listen, thank you for spending some time with us, and best of luck with hidinghilda.com. It's great talking to you today.
Thank you so much, Cam. I appreciate it.
This land, this is life's stadium. The people who enter must know it is not a place for media hype or cheering fans. The spotlights of sun and moon and stars will never showcase human arrogance. In fact, the only contest that is celebrated here is the Earth's determination to sustain life. Join this celebration. Arrive with a purpose. Compete on the world's most challenging fields. Winning and losing won't mean as much as just being. You will be among the most courageous and competitive athletes on the planet and in awe of its rules. Trust the hunter in your blood. Nearly all our projects are going to conflict with the natural world, if only in their absurd futility. their false sense of importance, gravity, and urgency in the face of our upcoming deaths. Only one project embraces death as the absolute that it is. Only one project confronts the absurdity by its very nature. The anti-hunters have imposed a false order on their lives based on a misconceived perception of the world. Death is evil, they believe, and so the purveyor of death must also be evil. But the world is its own, and it will have itself back.
Welcome back. It is Cam and Company, your first source for Second Amendment news and information, coming to you from a beautiful downtown Farmville, Virginia today. Still to come, an hour from now, Tim Lee joins us from the Center for Individual Freedom with this week's Liberty Update right now. I want to welcome from from National Review, Mr. Charles Cook is with us. Charles, how are you, sir? Do we have Charles?
Hello.
Hello.
You were on mute. I have two slightly noisy children, and I only just got rid of them. So you didn't hear them, and then you didn't hear me, but I'm here now.
I appreciate it. And, you know, if this was Skype, we would have had one of those viral moments, Charles, of the little kid opening the door and you know, playing in the background. But
exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. That only happens to the British, I think.
Even the British leaving. Well, now, see, you're an American citizen now, so I guess that can't happen to you anymore.
No, that's right. Actually, it's one of the things they said at the ceremony, actually, as I was now immune from that sort of embarrassment, so that's nice.
So listen, I'm glad you could join us on the program today. We've been talking, and we'll continue to talk, not just about what, you know, the gun control advocates are doing here in the wake of the shooting in Santa Fe, Texas, but also, I think looking at some of the real issues and the deeper underlying issues. You've got a piece, and you actually wrote this last Friday, Friday evening, at National Review. Senator Murphy demonstrates why gun control advocates are mistrusted. So it was Friday afternoon, just a couple of hours after the news broke about the shooting at Santa Fe High School in Texas. We didn't know a lot of information at the time, but Senator Murphy had said, let's call it like it is. The horrifying inaction of Congress, slaughter after slaughter, has become a green light to would-be shooters who pervert silence into endorsement. In other words, when Congress fails to pass gun control laws like those that Senator Murphy supports, that killers in this country not only take solace in this, but that they actually view this as a call from Congress to go out and commit crimes.
Yes. Well, I think there's a lot wrong with it. The first is that idea itself is ridiculous. The notion that somehow liberty is to blame, that if you don't intervene as a government, you're giving a green light to people who abuse their freedom. How far do you take it? When Ruth Bader Ginsburg votes with the whole Supreme Court to uphold the First Amendment, even if it protects anti-Semites, is she giving a green light to anti-Semitism? Is she endorsing it? Of course she's not. When the ACLU defends the right to a trial, the right to presumption of innocence, are they giving a green light to murderers? Of course they're not. And it's no different when it comes to the Second Amendment. It's an ugly idea in a free country. It's also a peculiar idea. He seems to see this as being some national psychodrama rather than a matter of law. But on the matter of law, I think he revealed quite a lot about himself. What exactly does he think Congress should have done to prevent this shooting? If you press figures such as Senator Murphy on the question of gun control, they will say, no, I have limited ambitions. I don't want to ban all guns. I don't want to repeal the Second Amendment. I just want to, and in his case, he would say, impose universal background checks, ban weapons with certain cosmetic features, which he calls assault weapons, and so forth. Not anywhere on his list is banning 38 caliber revolvers or shotguns, for that matter. But now he says that Congress has blood on its hands, that Congress is to blame, that Congress gave the green light. Well, there are really only two options here. If indeed Congress is to blame because it hasn't tried to prohibit shotguns and 38 caliber revolvers, then so is Senator Murphy, because he hasn't tried to do those things either. Or he actually does want to ban all guns, or at least has a far more ambitious gun control agenda than he's let on. One of those things has to be true.
You also have the grandstanding option as well, Charles. Don't forget that option, right?
Well, that's right. That's right. It's possible that upon seeing this abomination on the news, he just wrote that tweet in anger. But that would be irresponsible for a senator, especially given that he is indicting people and accusing them of being complicit with murder. And I think he should know better. And I think he does. I don't think that he was just reacting viscerally. I think he gave himself away.
So you think at the end of the day, if Chris Murphy would find it politically feasible to try to ban shotguns and revolvers, you think that he would do so?
I do. And I think it's worth saying here, so much of this debate is set up as if merely passing a law would change anything.
Yeah.
Senator Murphy believes that to pass a law prohibiting a certain sort of weapon or imposing a background check is to solve the problem. And you can tell that by the way he sets up everything he says,
mm-hmm.
that Congress is to blame because it hasn't prevented the next one, on the assumption being that it can. But it's always worth pointing out that not only would there be a huge number of unintended consequences to trying to pass such a law, not least of which would be unconstitutional, but I think it would also cause a number of problems within America that he doesn't even countenance. But even if he were to get whatever law he wants, I mean, the likelihood of it actually making any difference is tiny. And so to assume that the people who disagree with his proposals secretly know or secretly agree that would work, but they just don't want to do it because they're too selfish or they're too misanthropic is another reason why I think Second Amendment advocates are so suspicious of figures such as he, because it is simply not the case that everybody in America agrees on how we can stop this sort of thing, but that some of us are prepared to do it and some of us aren't. I vehemently disagree with Chris Murphy as to the efficacy of his ideas, leaving aside the constitutional question, leaving aside whether it would be a good idea to try to round up millions of weapons and, of course, therefore millions of people. But I don't think that he grasps that, and I think he does a disservice to our debate as a result.
Well, I would agree with you. I mean, I think the debate, we talked about this a little bit on the last segment. I think the debate has become, it's almost kabuki theater. I mean, you know that again before any information is known, you know that there are going to be anti-gun politicians like Senator Murphy that are out there trying to do something. I mean, as you say, you know, he didn't offer any specific policy proposals in that tweet. But what he offered was condemnation. But, you know, when you start to delve into, okay, well, what is it that Senator Murphy has called for in the past? As you say, none of those legislative efforts that Senator Murphy has put forth would have addressed the individual there in Texas who committed these atrocities on Friday. And then you start looking into, as you say, the efficacy of some of these policies to begin with, quote-unquote universal background checks. You know, we talked about this a few minutes ago. In New Mexico last year, when Democrats took over the state Senate, that was a big legislative priority for the anti-gun advocates. They thought that they could at least get a bill to Governor Martinez's desk, and maybe she'd sign it, maybe she wouldn't. The bill ended up not even getting out of committee, Charles, because there was so much grassroots opposition among gun owners, but also every county sheriff in New Mexico eventually came out in opposition to this bill, saying we don't know how we're going to enforce it. If we do enforce it, it's going to be, you know, after the fact when somebody's committed a crime and we're investigating, we realize, okay, this somebody transferred this gun without a background check, and then we could charge them with a misdemeanor, but we're already dealing with a violent criminal at that point, right?
Right.
You know, these are...
And that matters, Cam, and that matters.
Absolutely it matters, because
of these ideas are sold not as a means by which after the fact the state can prosecute the perpetrators, but as a means of stopping them in the first instance.
Mm-hmm.
If you listen to Senator Murphy, he is of the view that we can stop bad things from happening with universal background checks. Now, again, we know from recent data not compiled by National Review or the National Rifle Association, but by gun controllers, that the universal background check experiment in both Washington State and Colorado was a bust.
Yep.
Didn't make any difference at all. But even if it had had some marginal post hoc benefits, which it didn't, it would be worth noting that that is not the promise and that is not the justification. The justification is we know how to stop this. And one of the ways to do it is with universal background checks.
Yeah.
And that's simply false.
Well, not only, and you know, to go back to that that study that you referenced just a few moments ago, Garen Wintemute, who's an anti-gun researcher at UC Davis, he, as you say, he looked at what happened when Washington State and Colorado instituted their universal background checks and found really wasn't an increase. He also looked at what happened when Delaware instituted its universal background checks, and there he actually did find, all right, well, background checks for handguns went up. I think it was like 34%. For long guns, I think it was even higher. I think it was around 40%. But unfortunately for the gun control advocates of those three states, Washington State, Colorado, and Delaware, Delaware saw the biggest increase in its homicide rate, Charles. I mean, that was the state where you could actually say, oh, look, these universal background check laws worked. People actually did more background checks. They also saw the biggest increase in homicide of those three states.
And that's also a key point because, of course, the purpose of a universal background check law is not in a vacuum to lead to an increase in the number of background checks. It's to save lives. And it didn't.
Yep. So I'm curious, if you had an area of discussion, if you could sit down and talk with Senator Murphy and have an honest to goodness productive conversation, what would you ask him to focus on, Charles? What would you ask him to take a look at? Because, you know, for Chris Murphy, it always comes back to gun control. What do you think he's not looking at?
Well, I would say three things to him. The first is that although this in no way limits the scale of the tragedy that we saw in Texas and see far too often, I think everybody agrees, the United States is getting safer and schools are getting safer as well. They're not safe enough, but we are not in the middle of a crime wave. If you look at the statistics from 1990 onwards, it is the story of gun crime and crime in general going down. And I think we ought to start talking more as if that were the case instead of scaring people. I mean, I too found the footage of the girl saying this was inevitable to be harrowing, but she's wrong. I understand why she feels like that. I'm in no way criticizing her. She just went through something traumatic, but she is wrong. It's not inevitable. In fact, it is diminishing. The second thing I would say is that there are an awful lot of gun control laws on the books, many of which I support, many of which the NRA supports, many of which most Republicans support. One that has been the most successfully enforced in the last few months, and it must be said that although I'm not always a fan of his, Jeff Sessions should take the credit, is straw purchases and trafficking. The administration has done a really good job at upping efforts at the federal level to put people who buy guns for those who aren't allowed them and traffic them into criminal circles in jail, where they belong. And the third thing is, it's not as if there have been no new gun control laws or gun control efforts. The federal government just passed the Fix Nix bill. We need a little bit of time to see how that plays out. But there are holes in the system that need plugging. I just find it extraordinary that given how badly the current laws are enforced And given how badly the FBI's performance has been of late in tracking and stopping shooters, that there are people in Congress who want sweeping new regulations to hand to the people who can't enforce the existing laws. And as you said earlier when talking about universal background checks, you know, sheriffs in all sorts of states will tell you they simply can't enforce that, which is deemed to be a common sense gun control, just, you know, a small provision, let alone the sort of thing that that Chris Murphy tends to talk about. So I would ask him to discuss this within its correct context, to understand that there are efforts being made to enforce existing law, and to look at the changes that have been made that don't impinge upon law-abiding citizens, and that need a little time to work out before we would even countenance changing other laws, which for a whole host of other reasons that we've discussed on this show before, I generally oppose.
Talking again with Mr. Charles Cook of National Review. Charles, unfortunately, we've got to take a time out, but I do appreciate you coming on the program, sir. It's always good talking with you, and appreciate the insight.
Talk to you soon.
All right, Charles Cook. You can find Charles on Twitter at Charles C.W. Cook, and, of course, at nationalreview.com. We're going to take a time out. When we come back, Michael Graham, columnist at the Boston Herald, does a piece at CBS News, the problem with, quote-unquote, common sense gun laws, and we'll talk about that, as well as news out of Maine, where over the weekend, the Maine Democratic Party held its state convention, and it was pretty busy. So you've got seven Democrats who are vying for the nomination for governor in Maine. You've got three candidates running in a June 12th primary in the second congressional district. And as the Bangor Daily News reports, there is also interesting and overlooked debate around the party's platform, with a more moderate and older skewing crowd of party delegates rejecting certain items that progressives wanted to add to the state party's statement of value, values. One of those items that was hotly debated and ultimately rejected by the Maine Democratic Party, platform plank that supported a ban on quote-unquote assault weapons. That was voted down at the convention there for the Maine Democratic Party in Augusta over the weekend. And we'll get into the whys and the hows in just a little bit, but stick around. We have much more Cam and Company coming up right after this. It's competition season coming up here, and we've got a couple of big events to talk about. The Bianchi Cup and sort of the precursor to the Bianchi Cup, the Flagler Cup as well, right?
Right, and Mike Flagler passed away this year, and I've shot with him since in the mid-70s. He was a real good friend, so we'll go down and do that on the 17th, and then on to the World Cup in Colombia, and then the Bianchi Cup after that.
You know, it really is incredible, Kim, that there are three really world-class pistol competitions, just, you know, back to back to back. And I'm guessing that now a lot of the competitors are going to all three events if they can make it to all three. Has that been your experience?
Yes, especially the guys from overseas, because that gives them a chance to shoot three major matches while they're over here. I know we supply ammunition for all the Australians and the New Zealanders and the Germany people, so they're going to all make that, and it's just a warm-up for the world and then for the Bianchi.
And Kim, how long has Zero Bullets been participating in events like the World Cup and the Bianchi Cup?
For about almost 18 years.
That's amazing. And, I mean, you've obviously seen these competitions grow right along with Zero Bullets, frankly, over the last 18 years.
Yeah, you know, when we first started, when I first started in 81, there was just two of us that were there representing Zero Ammunition, and we didn't have a whole lot of people shooting our ammo, and now between our ammo and my bullets, I imagine we've got around 60 to 65% of the market.
For folks who have never been to any of these events, whether it's the Flagler Cup or the World Cup or the Bianchi Cup, maybe they're just starting to get interested in competitive shooting. What would you tell folks, what encouragement would you give them about why they should go out and either, you know, watch or even participate this year?
Well, I always tell anybody that the first, if they want to try action pistol, to start off, try and find a local club. And there's a lot of people that can help them get started on their journey. But, you know, they could start out with a standard revolver or their Glock or anything that they have in the production class and be competitive.
Again, talking with Kim Beckwith of Zero Bullets about the upcoming competitions there in the Missouri area, Flagler Cup, World's Cup, and Bianchi Cup. And Kim, obviously you're going to be out there for folks if they want to stop by, say hi, learn more about Zero Bullets.
Oh, sure. We always have a booth every year, and we'll be willing to take your orders. And if you have any problem with any type of other things, you know, it's a small community. And I know when we went to Germany, we had Sydney Sergi that was having trouble with a firearm. Well, I always have two, so I gave her one of mine to shoot so she could go ahead and compete.
See, and that right there, your story, Kim, I mean, that is the spirit, I think, of the competitive firearms world, where, yes, you are competing. Yes, it matters what your scores are. But at the end of the day, you're also looking out for each other. And there's a community there that I think is special.
Yeah, and you find that in a lot of the shooting sports. But we're kind of partial to the Bianchi family because a lot of these people we see once a year. Because a lot of them are overseas, and a lot of them have become really, really good friends.
How, you know, you talk about the overseas folks, the guys from New Zealand and Australia and Germany, and do you get a chance to talk much about what it's like just in terms of the training? Because some of these countries, again, with the very restrictive gun laws that they have, I would guess that not only impacts things like, you know, owning firearms for self-defense or for even hunting, But in the world of competitive shooting, does that impact their ability to train back at home?
Well, it really does. I know in Germany, your cases have to be locked completely going to and from the range, and they even are supposed to be locked in between each individual range when you go, and your ammunition cannot be carried in the same locked container as what your firearm is carried. And in some of them, in Australia, a lot of the guys can't take their competition pistols home.
Wow. Again, Kim Beckwith with Zero Ammunition. I want to thank you again for coming on the program, sir. I hope that you have a fantastic time. Maybe we can touch base with you down in Columbia at some point later this month.
Yeah, that'll be fine. We'll be getting ready to get our booth set up and get to see everybody and be willing to hit the range and see if I can get a third senior champion.
Welcome back to Cam and Company. Cam Edwards, your host. Glad that you are with us today. We are going to continue bringing you the latest out of Santa Fe, Texas. Kerry Pickett from NRA TV joined us on the ground earlier in the program. Glenn Reynolds, the blogger behind Instapundit.com and a contributor to USA Today, will join us next hour as well, about an hour from now, as a matter of fact, talking about his latest column, how we can inoculate ourselves against these types of acts of violence. Right now, I want to welcome to the program Michael Graham, columnist for the Boston Herald, his latest at CBS News, the problem with, quote-unquote, common-sense gun laws. Michael, thank you for your time today, sir.
Always thrilled to speak with you. By the way, I was almost late because I was out enjoying a beautiful cigar in the beautiful weather here in one of the few places I can find to legally have a cigar. I have to go out in the woods and smoke a cigar in Massachusetts. So it would be easier for me to smoke pot walking through downtown Boston than it is for me to have a cigar. It's ridiculous.
Wasn't that the opening to Walden? Right, I went to the woods so I could have a cigar. No, it was,
I think
no,
it was. It should have been.
Himself,
if you're fighting for individual liberty, that's what you got. You got to hide out in the woods here in Massachusetts. That's it. It's so funny because a couple of healthy people were by. There's this beautiful area called the Fells, which is kind of like a park, like New York City has Central Park, and it's kind of this area that's untouched and by, you know, and the it's full of, you know, dog walkers and speed walkers, and the bikers have those bicycles with the tires that look like they're from a cartoon, you know, the huge overinflated tires. And every one of them went by me, glared at my cigar like, if only they'd known what was in my flask, I would have been in real trouble. But fortunately, they didn't figure that out.
Well, I'm glad that you made it back in time to join us on the program this afternoon. Your column at CBS, I got to say, is really fantastic. And it just, you know, you point out things that frankly you shouldn't have to point out because we should have gotten past this by now. You know, the common calls for quote unquote common sense gun laws, and you cite examples. Senator Bernie Sanders, right? The American people are united overwhelmingly on quote common sense gun safety legislation, expand background checks, do away with the gun show loophole. Senator Chris Murphy, we just talked about with Charles Cook from National Review a couple of minutes ago. Calling for common sense gun laws and blaming Congress for providing a quote green light to would-be shooters who pervert silence into endorsement. But you note, Michael, that not one of those quote unquote common sense policies, had they been in place, would have stopped this attack at Santa Fe High School on Friday.
You know, it's funny. I'm the token conservative at CBS, and so they put me up, and they kind of wince as they post my stuff. It's like, oh, can we put that? You know, and we went through a couple of edits on it, which is fine. You know, that's their thing. But it was interesting, the number of people I talked to who just rejected the idea that, well, come on, you're saying that we can't do anything. And I'm saying, no, I'm saying that the things that people are actually talking about doing don't do any good. And you know they don't do any good, and you can tell they don't do any good. Everybody knows they don't do any good because this is about posturing and politics. I also want to go back and pick up on Senator Murphy saying that if you support the Second Amendment, you are giving a green light to the murderers. You know, if I said I don't want random searches of Muslims because I just think that's wrong. If you're an American citizen, doesn't matter where you worship, you've got the Constitution to protect you. And somebody said, oh, you're giving a green light to terrorists. These same people would go nuts. They would go, no, 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 you're wrong. We're protecting constitutional rights. To which I say, and your point about the Second Amendment is, hello? And I just don't understand. How can they not see the obvious correlation that defending constitutional rights of innocent people is not the same as giving a green light to murderers or terrorists or anyone else?
Well, I think that many of those folks do know it, but that's how they want to frame the argument.
Right.
Right. They want to frame the argument as, well, you care more if you don't, you know, sign on to what I'm calling for, then you must care more about guns than kids. If you don't agree with all of my gun control proposals, then, you know, you must just be spewing NRA propaganda, or you must be kowtowing to the gun lobby. It can't be that. Again, you have legitimate policy disagreements. You think that it would be better to focus on, and you offer a couple of suggestions in your column at CBS News, but to focus on things that would actually be aimed more at the individuals we're trying to stop rather than trying to restrict the rights of, you know, 80, 90 million Americans who are currently exercising their right to keep and bear arms. And if you, right, again, as you did, Michael, if you point out, okay, well, none of those policy solutions that you're advancing would have actually stopped this attack, then you get accused of not caring, of not wanting to find any sort of answer whatsoever. What you're saying, Michael, is that if it's not gun control, then this is just going to continue unabated. I think that these are all false premises, but that's how the argument goes these days.
And I want to commend Charles C.W. Cook, who was on earlier, making the point about Jeff Sessions really cracking down on illegal behavior by people with guns, an idea that he obviously stole from me and plagiarized. And I'm used to that from Charles. I mean, I'm totally kidding. I'm a huge Charles C.W. Cook fan. But there are things that you can do if you care about restricting gun crime. But they don't care about restricting gun crime. They care about restricting legal gun ownership. If you cared about restricting gun crime, what is the first thing you would do? You would enforce mandatory minimum sentences for people who commit crimes using guns. That is, like, to me, the no-brainer, dummy, easy-to-do policy. Here in Massachusetts, we have a mandatory minimum of a year, and it is almost always waived. Almost always. Because they have this other agenda, which is criminal justice reform. And I just want to say something. I get the argument that when you put someone, a young guy, in jail, you've really raised the odds that his life outcome is going to be negative, that he's going to engage in more crime later. I get that. But there's a difference between saying, what are we going to do about a low-rent pot dealer? What are we going to do about the kid who's a mule for his older brother who's, you know, busted with cocaine, versus what are you going to do about the guy with a gun? Let's put that guy in jail. And I would love to have like a big section in jail. This is the really sucky part of jail where people who use guns go, so that the other criminals will go, you know what? Whatever I do when I get out, I'm not going to do it with a gun. I'll use a knife, a stick, or whatever, but I'm not going to do it with a gun. That actually works. You know, France, God forbid we say anything nice about the French, but, you know, they have draconian laws when it comes to the amount of drugs you have. They treat low, you know, small possession drug dealers very differently from large possession drug dealers. And as a result, based on the research that I've seen, the drug dealers change their behavior, and so they spread the drugs out. Well, I'd love to see the same thing about guns, where people in Chicago who are protecting their corner, where they're selling recreational pharmaceuticals, they do so without a gun. What happens then? The volume of gun crime, which is already trending downward, goes down even further. But that's not the goal. The goal is, how can we stop Cam Edwards from owning a gun? And that's why the left's position is not common sense at all. It's common stupidity. It's insanely stupid to walk away from stuff that would work because you want to pursue an agenda about attacking the Second Amendment.
Listen, I'm right there with you. And I would go even one step further when you talk about this, the horns of the dilemma that you describe Democrats facing right now. We saw this play out really explicitly in Baltimore last year. As Baltimore was going through its third straight year of 300-plus homicides, the city council says, okay, you know what, we got to get tough. And described a situation very similar to what you just described, right? People who are caught in illegal possession of a gun in Baltimore and really in Maryland, they're supposed to do hard time, but they often take plea deals and they're put on probation. So Baltimore says, okay, we're going to do what we can. We're going to introduce a bill here locally, city council, that if you're caught in illegal possession of a gun, you're going to do a year in jail. Not going to be state prison, but it's going to be a year in jail.
Right.
And there was a near riot in the city council chamber during the first committee hearing for this. And it wasn't, you know, pro-gun activists. It was community activists who said, listen, if you pass this law, my son, my brother, my father, guys who are carrying guns, not because they're violent criminals, but because they live in Baltimore and they want to be able to protect themselves, they're going to be the ones who are hurt by this. Council backs off, ends up passing an ordinance that says, okay, upon first offense, you're not going to go to jail if you're caught in illegal possession of a firearm. And yet the community activists, the city council members, nobody spoke up and said, and you know what? There needs to be a way for people to be able to legally carry a firearm for self-defense in Baltimore, Maryland, because our right to bear arms is not being recognized right now. And I was stunned that nobody actually brought that up. They agreed, okay, this law is ripe for abuse. This law is going to put nonviolent individuals who are just carrying a firearm for self-defense in behind bars for a year. And yet nobody wanted to take that extra step to say, well, why don't we focus on the violent criminals? And why don't we also ensure that my son, my brother, my father, me, as a law-abiding resident of Baltimore, can carry a firearm for self-defense without worrying about going to jail?
Because that's not the point of letting people walk or get a waiver on possession of guns. The point is that there are communities in the United States, for all sorts of historic reasons, particularly black and Hispanic young men, who are more likely to be involved in the kind of commercial but unlicensed activities that involve using a gun for your job. And those are the brothers and uncles and cousins and family members that people are trying to protect. It is really about keeping people out of jail based on their skin color, which is, you know, there are problems without a doubt. And I would love to see an effort, particularly led by the right, to force capitalism to help it bloom so that people, a 17-year-old kid who wants to have hope, but he tries to get a job and everywhere he goes, he's competing often with illegal labor that's working under the table. He can't get a decent job. He can't make enough money to move out of his parents' house. But an option that's available is something that's illegal and it involves carrying a gun. That's the debate that the left needs to resolve. They've got to decide what is more important to you, stopping gun crime or trying to help people who make mistakes recover in a smart way from those mistakes. And right now they are firmly on the side of the bad guys with guns and instead pursuing the good guys with guns. That's why you're never going to hear a defense of good guys with guns. They don't believe there's such a thing as a good guy with a gun.
Yeah, inconvenient truths. Michael, listen, I appreciate you coming on the program, sir. We'll let you get back to that cigar in the woods and the harassment of bicyclists. But you have a fantastic afternoon, sir. Hope we get a chance to do this again soon.
No, it's great. And by the way, be warned, I've been asked by the folks at CBS to give them your take on what's going on post Santa Fe. So you may be quoted tonight on CBSN. Just be warned.
Okay. All right. We'll talk to you
That's
soon.
Not a good Michael thing, Cam. Trust me. It's not a good thing.
Be gentle, Michael. Michael Graham joining us here on Cam and Company on Twitter at I am M Graham. Tim Lee joining us from the Center for Individual Freedom next hour. Also next hour, Glenn Reynolds, the blogger behind Instapundit.com, law professor at the University of Tennessee. Top of the hour, we have today's hero of the day. We have our deal of the day, good guy as well. And the Bangor Daily News reporting over the weekend, the Maine Democratic Party held its state convention in Lewiston, Maine. Highlighted by speeches from six of their seven gubernatorial hopefuls, three candidates running in a June 12th primary in the second congressional district. The crowd of delegates, according to the Bangor Daily News, voted down support for a ban on, quote, military-style assault weapons after speeches from delegates, including former State Senator John Patrick of Rumford, Maine, who was unseated by Republican Lisa Keim in a rural district that the Bangor Daily News says took a hard right turn in 2016. Now, here's the thing. I'm currently reading Selena Zito and Brad Todd's The Great Revolt. I'm guessing that this county didn't take a hard right turn in 2016. I'm guessing that the residents there of that district felt like the incumbent, Senator Patrick, wasn't representing, and that the Democratic Party overall was not going to be representing the interests of those residents there. I don't think this was a hard right turn that suddenly thousands of people in a county took in 2016. I think it was just that they felt like the Democratic Party wasn't speaking to them anymore. Patrick told the crowd that as he went door to door in his district, the question that he got most was where he stood on the Second Amendment. He said Democrats need to win the Blaine House, which is the governor's mansion in Maine, and legislative majorities to make gun law changes. And, quote, if you want to unelect Democrats in rural areas, pass this legislation, the gun ban approval, because that's what you're going to get. In other words, yeah, put this you know, gun ban in your platform here. And you're going to find fewer Democrats elected from rural districts in Maine, not more. Now, note as well what he said. We got to elect Democrats so we can actually pass gun control laws, but don't talk about it right now. Well, we're going to actually talk a little bit more about this coming up in hour three. Also, hero of the day, deal of the day, and our good guys to stick around. Hour three of Cam and Company is coming up right after a quick break. We'll be back. Our friend Gabby Franco is here. Gabby, we're so grateful that we have your voice and your experience to help us understand a little bit more about what's going on in the country that you grew up
in. It is important for the American people to understand what's going on because, as we know, the news doesn't necessarily tell us all the truth,
right?
Or partially, you know, give us information in a way that may fill up their whatever they want to tell us, and it's not necessarily that real, the actual truth. So that's why we are here.
Well, absolutely. And I tell you what, we are going to talk a little bit about what's going on in Venezuela. But before we do that, I just want to talk about what's going on with you. What's your 2018 shaping up to be like? What are your goals for this year?
Well, I have, first and foremost, as a mother, that's my goal for a long time.
Right?
You know, be the best mother I can be.
Are we into the potty training stage yet?
Not yet. But, you know, that my son is the one who keeps me motivated to do what I do and how I do it. Because I'm like, I look at him and I just see, what can I show him in the future? He can say, okay, my mom did all this. My mom had a voice for this. You know, it's empowering him for his future. So what I want for this year is pretty much doing what I've been doing, just promoting the sport, educating more people, and with my seminars, not only about the shooting itself, mm-hmm. but the mental aspect, I think, is very important. Like I said, the technique of shooting is the same. It has been the same for decades. We align the sights in a way, we pull the trigger smooth, but what happens when we think, oh, can I do it? I shouldn't. Maybe I do it this way. So the brain is our biggest, our mind is our biggest trickster.
Yeah.
So I do that. I also going to be a guest speaker at the Texas State Shooting Association, so I'm very... Rifle Association, I'm sorry. I'm very proud of that. That's going to be on March 3rd in Houston, Texas.
Fantastic.
So that's going to be great. And, you know, competing, I'm going to keep competing local and regional matches, something that doesn't keep me away for long,
right,
from my son and my family. But that's, I think that's what, you know, you keep your values, family values, and still as a mother, I'm an entrepreneur. I have my own business and everything, but you know, you just make things happen. I make things happen.
You do make things happen, right? You just get it done. You say, I want to do this, and then you do.
Yes.
But, you know, let me ask you, how hard is it to find that balance? Because, you know, as you say, being a parent, the most important job that there is, yeah, right? And so that's priority number one. But part of being a parent is providing for your kids. That means putting food on the table, a roof over their head, you know, you got to clothe them. So have you found it difficult to strike that balance, the work-home life balance, or have you figured out a way to do it?
It is. But, you know, we only have 24 hours
right?
in a day. We only have 7 days, 365, and lucky 366 days in a year. But what I found out is that how to manage my time, you know, being more effective and have my goals. Understand, I am a person that really like to do things, and then I say, okay, wait a second, this is a priority, do that. My website, GabbyFranco.com, is going to come up very, very soon with products and everything, so I'm very proud of that.
Nice.
So that's I think, I actually think having a family and having the difficult times on managing that is what makes you be creative. It's like, what can I do? Even though I have this difficult, you know, I can't travel as much as I do and everything because I want to be with my family. Mm-hmm. But what else can I do? So it makes you creative, makes you more, you know, think more about the possibilities.
Right.
And that's when you make great things.
You're watching NRA TV with Cam Edwards.
Welcome back. Hour three of Cam and Company starts right now here on NRA TV, Patriot 125, on your Sirius XM satellite radio. Apple, Amazon, and more on the program this hour. We'll be talking with Tim Lee from the Center for Individual Freedom for the Liberty Update. Also, Glenn Reynolds, the blogger behind Instapundit.com, University of Tennessee law professor. His latest column at USA Today, after Texas school shooting, how can we inoculate ourselves against the next one? And this is something that we're going to be talking quite a bit about, not just today, but in the short term, in the medium term, in the long term future. What can we do? Because, again, the gun control solutions offered up by Senator Murphy and others would not have prevented this attack. There seems to be a growing realization, even among, you know, some who have been reluctant to acknowledge this previously, that maybe the answer, you know, is actually, what do we do to make our schools safer? What can we do to harden up those targets? What can we do as far as bringing school resource officers to campuses? What can we do about armed school staff in some situations? But the answers, again, offered by the gun control advocates aren't really answers at all in this case. And it appears as well, we've got our hero of the day, our deal of the day, and our good guy coming up in just a couple of minutes. But we were just talking about what happened in Maine over the weekend, where the Democratic Party, hosting its annual convention, and at that annual convention, there was a motion to include in the party platform a ban on, quote, military-style assault weapons. And this was rejected, apparently by a large majority of the delegates. According to the Bangor Daily News, the vote was overwhelming, even as gubernatorial candidates called for gun control in their speeches on Saturday after the platform debate. So think about that for a second. And if you've never been, by the way, to a state party convention, you should go sometime. They're really, really fascinating. So you've got delegates from around the state of Maine. They're gathered there to work on this party platform. This is going to be, again, the agenda items that the Democratic Party in Maine going to carry forward into the election. And progressives have this platform plank that would have banned, semi-automatic firearms. They called them, quote, military-style assault weapons. And as Michael Shepard of the Bangor Daily News, who is there on hand, reported, they rejected adding that support for a ban in a pretty overwhelming vote. So they reject this. You've got a former lawmaker who was ousted back in 2016
And he says, listen, when I was going door to door in my district, the number one question I got was, where do you stand on the Second Amendment? And he said, if you want to unelect Democrats, then go ahead and pass this platform plank, because that's what you're going to get. You're going to get more rural losses. Now, here's the thing. I don't know Senator John Patrick of Rumford, Maine. I don't know what his legislative record was like. I don't know if he was A-rated by the NRA or F-rated by the NRA or somewhere in between. I don't know. But it really doesn't matter, because even if Senator Patrick had been a staunch Second Amendment supporter, if his constituents felt like, okay, well, you know what, John, we like you. You haven't been the problem, but it's your colleagues there in the Democratic Party that are the problem. When we elect you, if you're going to be part of the majority, then, you know, you're going to be an odd man out arguing for our Second Amendment rights while the rest of your party is going to be out there attacking them and attacking us as law-abiding gun owners. I mentioned Selena Zito's book, The Great Revolt, which I have on the shelf behind me here. And I am literally about halfway through Selena's book right now. And I'm on the chapter called Girl Gun Power. Selena's book and Brad Todd's book, The Great Revolt, Inside the Populist Coalition, Reshaping American Politics, focuses on seven different types of voters who voted for Donald Trump in the 2016 election. And in some cases, you might have expected them to do so. In other cases, it was kind of surprising that they did so. But one of those seven archetypes that Selena and Brad note and spend a lot of time talking about are women who are Second Amendment supporters, women who are gun owners, and who care very much about their right to keep and bear arms. Now, I think what, you know, this a news article in Maine demonstrates is that, again, this is a gender-neutral topic where you've got men and women who both support our right to keep and bear arms. But again, you've got men and women who both support our right to keep and bear arms, and this is an important issue for both of them. But we did see in a lot of rural districts, and Selena and Brad talk about in their book, a lot of rural districts that went for Barack Obama in 2008, went for Barack Obama in 2012, went solidly for Donald Trump in 2016. And one of the key issues in those counties where you saw that swing was support for the right to keep and bear arms. So, again, they're looking in Maine at you need rural districts to win. You need rural districts in Maine to have a governing majority. And so you've got lawmakers, former lawmakers like Senator John Patrick, who say, don't talk about this. Don't endorse these policies or you're going to lose seats. And the delegates agree. Okay, well, let's not support a gun ban on our platform plank. And what happens? Then the candidates start talking, and they're all talking about the need for gun control. And we got to do this, and we got to do that. Ethan Strimling, who's the mayor of Portland, Maine, tweeted afterwards that the vote by the delegates was so disappointing. Now, again, the delegates overwhelmingly voted against a gun ban in their party platform. The Portland mayor, very disappointed by the actions of delegates from across the state. I imagine that they were probably fairly disappointed that the proposed plank was brought up to begin with. But again, in a lot of areas of the country, if you're playing politics with this issue, and sadly, a lot of politicians are playing politics with this issue, you're going to find Americans on the right, in the middle, and on the left who don't appreciate, don't accept being blamed for the actions of criminals, and they will, left, right, and in the muddy middle, they will vote accordingly. Now, let's get to today's hero of the day, our deal of the day, our good guy of the day. Hero of the day from Roanoke, Virginia, a couple hours to our west here in Farmville, Virginia. A story about a, well, let's see if I can find this story. It appears to have just disappeared on me. Gentleman who made a deal to sell a motorcycle over the weekend. Met up with the prospective buyer on Friday. It was just around 6:30 in the afternoon. All right, well, hang on a second. I'm having some trouble with the link here. The link might have disappeared, but I can give you the gist of the story. Met with the intended buyer 6:30 approximately Friday afternoon, said, okay, before I hand over the bill of sale and the title and everything, can I go ahead and get the money for the bicycle or for the motorcycle? That is when the suspect in this case, who had been joined by a buddy of his, pulled out a gun and demanded the keys and the title to said motorcycle from the would-be seller, who was also legally armed. And the would-be seller of the motorcycle drew his firearm, actually shot one of the suspects who was taken to the county jail, now facing the charges. The second suspect also actually arrested there at the scene and is facing charges as well. The individual who was attempting to sell the motorcycle not facing any charges because he was acting in self-defense. And again, this is not the first time that we've run across a story like this where somebody, you know, makes a connection on Craigslist. Okay, you know, want to meet here to sell whatever item it is that I'm selling. And they're the victim of a robbery. And unfortunately, it doesn't always work out that the intended robbery victim is an armed citizen who can defend themselves. Now, a lot of police departments around the country now offer up their parking lots, offer up, you know, other public places that are well lit, that may have, you know, closed circuit TV cameras as a place to engage in these exchanges in a way that's a little bit safer. It's, again, it's no guarantee, because we've actually seen stories where people have been robbed in the police department parking lot. So that happens too. But it is a little bit safer than just meeting on some random street corner or a back alley somewhere or some stranger's home and engaging in your commerce in that regard. But we're glad that that concealed carry holder was able to protect himself there in Roanoke, Virginia. Our deal of the day from the T&D in South Carolina, Orangeburg, South Carolina. Authorities looking for a man accused of firing at officers in a Coleman Avenue home last Thursday morning. 18-year-old Darian Latrell James allegedly fired a weapon at officers around 6 o'clock in the morning as they arrested another occupant of the home. The officers were not injured, but James fled the home and at last reported his condition and whereabouts unknown. Investigators with the U.S. Marshals Service and the local sheriff's office there in Orangeburg County were in the process of serving 6 attempted murder warrants on 17-year-old Neshquan Hampton. And as they were in the process of serving those 6 attempted murder warrants, that is when Darian Latrell James allegedly fired at them. Hampton was taken into custody. He did not shoot at officers. The warrants for Hampton's arrest accused him of opening fire at a home on Baxter Street in Orangeburg County in the early morning hours of May the 10th. A woman called deputies at 1 o'clock in the morning on May the 10th to report that she was inside her residence. 3 juveniles were also in there when she heard gunshots. Initially, she thought they were fireworks, so she said she opened the door for a friend who was outside. The friend told deputies that she was seated inside of her vehicle when shots rang out. She took cover in her car. When she looked up, she saw a man shooting at cars in the driveway. Another witness who was parked nearby told deputies he didn't see anything, but he heard something that sounded like fireworks. He told deputies that he took cover in his vehicle when he heard, when he realized that they were gunshots. The house, the vehicle suffering damage from the gunshots. 6 homes across the Orangeburg area were shot into. By the way, May 9th and 10th, the 17-year-old has only been charged in one incident at this point. Now, according to the T&D, Mr. James, the individual who shot at law enforcement officers and was arrested when his buddy was being arrested on these outstanding warrants, currently on supervised probation through the South Carolina Department of Probation, Parole, and Pardons. In late January of this year, the 18-year-old pleaded guilty to unlawful carrying of a pistol, possession of a stolen vehicle, and hit and run causing property damage. Supervised probation is set to end January 24th, 2021. Now, again, we do a deal of the day every day on this program, in part to highlight the light sentences that a lot of repeat offenders continually receive. But I couldn't help but, you know, notice the charges here. And again, you've got no shortage of anti-gun politicians, anti-gun entertainers, anti-gun celebrities, anti-gun activists who are demanding more laws be put on the books. Laws that would primarily be directed at you and I, but conceivably could have, I don't know, some potential impact on a violent criminal. In many cases, again, I doubt it. But nobody really wants to talk about what happens to individuals, again, who right now caught unlawful carrying of a pistol, as well as possession of a stolen vehicle and hit and run. What happens to that individual? Do they go behind bars for a long period of time when they're caught, when they're arrested, when they're convicted? No, they don't. They typically get probation. First offense, right? Now, again, that was back in January when this guy was put on probation. Already back out on the streets. And now facing much more serious charges for allegedly opening fire on law enforcement officers. But rather than, again, talk about, well, what happens when you get busted for illegally having a gun, as well as being in possession of a stolen vehicle, as well as causing a hit-and-run accident? What happens there? What happens when you're arrested for armed robbery and you walk away with a 9-month prison sentence? What happens when you're an individual in Yarmouth, Massachusetts, and you rack up 110 different arrests and convictions, and your longest prison stint was, I think, 4 years for heroin distribution? We don't want to talk about how the laws that we have on the books are enforced. Lawmakers don't want to talk about that because, again, it doesn't really benefit them. They're lawmakers. What do? They make laws. They don't enforce them. A lot of law enforcement officers don't really want to talk about what happens in the criminal justice system, although more and more of them are becoming more and more outspoken. But you want to talk about a real crisis and a real problem. We can talk about the failures of the criminal justice system to actually deal with violent offenders. And Mr. James there in Orangeburg, South Carolina. Well, he is today's deal of the day. Our good guy of the day. And our good guy brought to you, as always, by our friends at Odor Crusher. Modesto, California, the Modesto Bee. Police, late last week, looking for the victim of a purse snatching that was foiled by an off-duty detective and a good Samaritan who chased down the suspect at a Modesto grocery store. 19-year-old Sonny Wilkins is suspected of stealing a woman's purse on Wednesday evening at the Save Mart grocery store. He was arrested on suspicion of robbery, 2 counts of attempted robbery, elder abuse, as well as violating his probation, because, yeah, he too, out on probation. Police officials believe that Wilkins also responsible for another purse snatching, as well as an attempted mugging earlier on Wednesday at other stores in Modesto, California. He was apprehended after he grabbed the woman's purse at the Save Mart grocery store. An off-duty Modesto police detective was inside the store when the purse snatching occurred. The detective, as well as a good Samaritan who saw what was going on, chased Wilkins down and detained him. Officials believe the woman recovered her purse, but she left before speaking with the police, which could complicate efforts to actually prosecute this individual. Good Samaritan, aiding that off-duty officer and the off-duty officer himself, who was able to come to the aid of this victim in the right place at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing. And we thank them both for being some of the many, many good guys out there. All right, we've got to take a time out. When we return, our friend Tim Lee joins us from the Center for Individual Freedom. Later in the hour as well, Glenn Reynolds, the blogger behind Instapundit.com, University of Tennessee law professor and contributing columnist to USA Today, joins us. We'll talk about his latest column at USA Today. How can we inoculate ourselves against these acts of violence like what we saw in Santa Fe, Texas on Friday? Stick around. We have much more Cam and Company on the way right after this.
Tell me about the partnership between Pigman and Grunstop.
I had the opportunity of meeting Pigman and his great and wonderful crew at SHOT Show this year. And we sat down in a bar of all places and really just started talking back and forth on what the Pigman brand was all about, right? And, I was doing all the drinking, right? He was doing all the talking. But, you know, really talking about what the Pigman brand is all about. And I was like, man, this is just so awesome, right? How he's able to work in this outdoor community. And this is really what the Grunstyle brand is all about, right? Is Americana, right? And what is more American than going out and you know, spending some good time out in the field, out in the bush, you know, doing some good American hunting, right? And, you know, enjoying those types of things out in the outdoor space. And that's what Gunstyle is, right? We're pride and self, pride and military, pride and country, business, veteran-owned, veteran-operated. And I couldn't be more proud to be partnered with somebody that really exemplifies all of those pillars of our ethos. And it's just been really exciting up to the few months that we've got to this point. And now we're on the path of moving forward, and you're going to see a lot of Pigman in the Gunstyle space and the social medias. And we're very, very happy and excited for this partnership that is coming out.
Man, those are the nicest things I've ever heard about you from somebody whose last name isn't Quokka.
This dude has hit his head or something coming in there. What it is he's very modest. These guys are the force in apparel on social media. So everybody's, everything is social media related now. You know this. Everything is digital. These guys destroy everybody that tries to live in that space. I'm like, wow, I watched them grow. And what I noticed at SHOT Show and at this convention last year is how many people are walking around with the Gunstyle. You did a test at SHOT Show one year, and like you had people at like six different places, right? And you was counting how many people had Gunstyle shirts on. It's scary.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean,
they make cool shirts. It's all about the Second Amendment. That's what they're about. And I'm pretty matter of fact. I like to just kind of tell people, you know, this is what I believe. And if you don't like it, you can turn the channel.
Right.
And that's kind of what they're about. That's what they stand for. And they're great people.
It is the dream of the animal rights fanatics to suppress your most natural connection to the earth. To sell you a life filled with urban fascinations. To ignore that death is life's unwavering partner. Together, creating a relationship between predator and prey that makes it possible for us all to survive. To the hunter, this world's most honest steward, these fantasies are the poisonous, perverted manipulations of social misfits who would take this planet hostage. They should startle you and awaken you to trust the hunter in your blood. There are places only the hunter knows. Places where there is nowhere else. Where if you think of nothing, perhaps you will feel the ceaseless past begin to stir beneath your feet, and a chorus of voices whisper something you could never explain how you know. What it felt like the moment the mammoth appeared. The utter stillness of the battle. And the primal celebration that followed the kill. But maybe you don't need to explain it. Maybe it explains you. Trust the hunter in your blood.
Welcome back to Cam and Company. Glad you have joined us today. Cam Edwards, your host. Still to come on the program, Glenn Reynolds, the blogger behind Instapundit.com, University of Tennessee law professor and the author of a good column at USA Today after the Texas school shooting. How can we inoculate ourselves against the next one? We certainly know about the calls for gun control, even if those soundbite solutions would not have prevented the attack there in Santa Fe, Texas on Friday. Glenn actually starts getting into the tougher questions of what can we do to actually turn this tide, and what can we do to both inoculate the would-be victims of these types of attacks, as well as treating the infection itself. And we'll talk with Glenn coming up here in about 20 minutes or so. Right now, I want to welcome to the program our friend Tim Lee from the Center for Individual Freedom. Tim, how are you, sir?
Doing well.
Looks like I'm a little close to the camera, so I'll back off a little bit. Nobody wants to see my face like that. But, yeah, everything's great here. And like you said, you know, the real key is, you know, everybody comes up with the same excuses and same non-solutions every time. But, you know, Greg Abbott, Texas governor, was on earlier this morning, too, on WMAL. And, you know, he talked about fortifying schools and things of that sort. So those are going to be better solutions, obviously, than those who oppose Second Amendment rights and the things they want to do, because obviously that wouldn't have had an effect in this case. We're talking about a shotgun, as I understand it, and you can get shotguns even in England and places like that. So obviously the typical gun controlist rhetoric falls flat on this one. So we do need to think. You know, you use the term think outside the box, but that's precisely what needs to occur here. But I think that lies more in the end of fortifying schools and ensuring safety in that regard at the point rather than, you know, infringing on the rights of everybody else, as we talk about on this show often.
Yeah, well, you know, and again, look, we certainly are willing to have this conversation in this debate. But, you know, when you've got folks like Senator Chris Murphy of Connecticut who are, you know, offering up a condemnation of Congress for failing to act, and yet he can't cite a proposed one of his proposed pieces of legislation that would have actually made an impact on this individual. You know, at some point, Tim, I think more Americans come to this realization of, OK, so this is, you know, political pontificating as opposed to actually offering up policy solutions, which, frankly, may not come in the form of legislation, right? You don't need legislation to start looking at how to harden up schools. You don't need federal legislation. I mean, maybe you could talk about, you know, grant money to schools who want to retrofit, you know, their physical facilities, but you don't need federal legislation to do that. You don't need federal legislation to talk about adding school resource officers or even armed school staff, although, again, maybe you can, you know, spend some federal grant money towards that end. But, you know, lawmakers, their job is to make law, right? And so when a lawmaker says we need to do something, maybe I'm just cynical, but to me, when I hear a politician say we need to do something, that means, okay, we need to make a law, and then we'll leave it up to somebody else to actually enforce that law or not. But their job is done. Once they've made their law, their job is done. They can then step back and tell their constituents, look, I said we need to do something, and I did something. Even if the law doesn't pass, they can propose legislation and say, look, I tried to do something. And they don't ever have to talk about the efficacy or the effectiveness of these laws. When Martin O'Malley was governor of Maryland back in 2012, when the murders at Sandy Hook Elementary took place, and he signed the Maryland Firearm Safety Act into law in 2013, again, this was designed to make Maryland safer. That was supposedly what was going to happen. And instead, Baltimore, Maryland, 2015, 16, and 17, three straight years of 300-plus homicides in that city after the passage of this sweeping gun control. And you know, Tim, there wasn't that wasn't brought up in any of the early presidential debates when Martin O'Malley was still a candidate for the Democrats. And I think he got about 2% in the first primary and then pulled out. This wasn't brought up by the Baltimore Sun editorial page. Nobody wanted to go back and actually look at, okay, well, if we said all of these things were going to happen when we passed these gun control laws and then things got worse, why did they get worse? And to me, if you're a gun control advocate, unless it really is just about putting as many gun laws on the books as you can possibly get away with, why wouldn't you go back? If it's about public safety, if it's about making people's lives better, why would you not go back and look at why you failed and why these policies failed?
Well, subjectively, it's because we're in a culture war. And a lot of times politics these days is sort of a flashing of gang signs almost. You know, it's how you tell the rest of the world what type of great person you are by just saying these things that have no effect. It's sort of like climate change. We talk about that here all the time. To the extent there are climate issues that need to be fixed, they're not in the typical array of talking points from those on the far left. What they do is they virtue signal that way. And it's the same way with the Second Amendment. They're not interested in solutions. You know, here's another question, too. You talked about asking those who advocate change or more laws you know, how would this have worked or what can actually work? You can almost reverse it and say to them when they say, I just support common sense laws and I'm not trying to take away anybody's guns and I don't oppose the Second Amendment. In a debate, if you're a political figure or if you're a moderator, or if you're just a citizen at a town hall, ask that politician or candidate, what gun laws in America do you find too extreme? Because what happens is they say they're only for common sense gun restrictions and that they favor the Second Amendment, but I've never heard them say, yeah, this one went too far. The DC gun ban, which was so bad and so restrictive that after 200 years, the Supreme Court finally said, no, we are going to say that this violates the Second Amendment. The DC gun ban itself was favored by politicians like Barack Obama, who said, I only favor common sense gun laws. Well, if you favor the most extreme laws in America, I think by definition, you don't just support common sense firearms restrictions. You support essentially endless ones, and you would prefer that nobody be armed, frankly, except for the people protecting you, of course. So turning it around and asking them that question is another effective way of doing it and saying, okay, so name something that is beyond the pale. What goes too far? And watch them struggle. Mm-hmm. That's usually what will happen.
Yeah, no, you're right, because that is one of those. And again, it's another one of those statements that, you know, any anti-gun politician or celebrity can make, and they never get called out on it, right? I support the Second Amendment, but. I support the Second Amendment, but we need these common sense gun safety legislation. Yeah, so give us an example of something that you would not consider to be common sense. Now, maybe these days you would find the expedient answer would be, I don't want to repeal the Second Amendment. Right. I don't want to do what Justice John Paul Stevens called for and just try to get rid of the Second Amendment. I think that goes too far. Maybe that would be the easy out for anti-gun activists if you actually offered them, give me something that goes too far.
You know, another thing to keep in mind, too, is, and I'm not a big proponent of slippery slope arguments or using the term slippery slope, because theoretically, even a traffic law is a slippery slope to the Soviet rule. But in the case of firearms restrictions, the slippery slope argument really does apply. If you think back to almost any issue that 10 years ago, those on the left politically said, well, I support this, but not that. That, you know, this is going too far. And then 2 years later, what do you know? They're supporting the thing that they said in 2008 that they didn't support. That's the way it is with the left. It's a ratchet effect. It's never enough. And you always keep going and you just sort of jettison those old promises of yesteryear. So, yeah, to hear somebody say, well, you know, I'm looking to take assault rifles away and keep them from the hands of criminals. But then a few years down the road, when they start talking about revolvers or shotguns or, you know, sporting goods stores even having restrictions on selling shotguns to somebody who's 18, 19, 20 years old. People applaud that. So look at their behavior more than their words. If they applaud things like that, then it's clear that they're favorable toward just taking guns from other people and prohibiting people from having them. So, but I think people catch on to this, and that's why polls consistently show that people support the Second Amendment. It's also why some of these political figures that want, or at least say they want to pass some of these laws, don't ever get it done because they know that the popular support is not there. So that's the good news. But we can't rest. We've got to keep it that way and maintain that support amongst the public for the Second Amendment, because ultimately that's where it matters. It doesn't matter what, you know, Rosie O'Donnell says on Twitter or Barbara Streisand or somebody like that. What matters is actual voters and, you know, reaching them as you do with your show is what really matters in the end. So fortunately, on the large scale, we're winning that war and we continue to win that war. We've just got to keep it up.
Well, absolutely. Although I would say even beyond, you know, even beyond the gun debate, I think that it's also important, and I hope that politicians, you know, we saw Governor Abbott said that he's going to host some roundtable discussions. He says, let's bring everybody to the table. I saw earlier today that some lawmakers in Washington State want to have a special session on school safety, and lawmakers that are proposing this say, look, we're not going to talk about, gun control that's not going to pass. We're going to talk about things that we can actually get done. things that we can put in effect that are going to make a difference and are going to have an impact. And I hope that we're able to actually do that, Tim. I hope that we're able to have the conversation and that debate over what can we do to increase the safety of those kids at school. You know, last week we saw a lot of eye rolling and derision when Texas Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick talked about hardening up these schools, right? And he said, you know, there you walk into a school, and a lot of these schools have got multiple entrances, they got multiple exits. You know, what would happen if we were to say, all right, to come into the school, you got to go through that main entrance there, and you're going to have, you know, your biometric ID card, you're going to have your scanner. And again, people, oh, you know, there's going to be a fire hazard. Oh, you can't do that. We're just going to have one, you know. And again, you can have points of exit. You can have fire exits that don't have, you know, handles on the outside. So you can't use them to get into the building, but you can use them to exit the building. Like, that's such a I've just seen so many excuses to avoid talking about these things in favor of, well, let's talk about these gun control policies that wouldn't have made a difference here, because that's what they really want to talk about. They don't want to talk about school safety. They don't want to talk about the safety of students. They want to talk about gun control. And look, I'm happy to have that conversation too, Tim. You know, we do 3 hours a day, 5 days a week, so I can talk gun control all day long. But we do a disservice to those students, those faculty members, those administrators, when we're not talking about those solid steps that we can take to better ensure the safety of everybody inside those buildings.
Yeah, and I agree with bringing in people who take a different position. Obviously, there are some people so extreme that they're not going to listen to logic. But frankly, there are a lot of people out there who sort of reflexively say that they favor more firearms restrictions just because, you know, they don't follow the issue particularly closely. And it feels good to say, hey, I want to end these shootings, and so therefore I want to restrict guns. A lot of reasonable people who might take that position on a soft basis, when you do bring them into the discussion and you show them the facts and you look at the statistics for countries that prohibit firearms but have much higher mass shooting rates and much higher murder rates than the United States, and you just give them the statistics about guns in America and the drop in crime over the last 25 years, even as guns became more prevalent, when they start to learn those facts, you do persuade a lot of them. So I agree that we can't just speak amongst ourselves. We've got to bring all those people to the table, if for no other reason than when they see the facts. A lot of times they come to our side, and we can get things done that actually will work. So totally echo your sentiment on that.
Excellent. Tim, listen, I appreciate you joining us on the program, sir. It's always good talking with you, and hope to continue the discussion here very soon.
Sounds great. Everybody have a good week.
You too, sir. Tim Lee joins us from the Center for Individual Freedom. Now, after a quick break right here on Cam and Company, we're going to be joined by Glenn Reynolds, University of Tennessee law professor, the man behind Instapundit.com, and a contributing writer to USA Today. He's got a column out today talking about what we can do, what we actually can do to inoculate ourselves as a society against these types of events, the type of just wanton murder that we saw at Santa Fe High School in Texas last Friday. And there are things that we actually can do. Not going to be easy. Sometimes it's not even going to be a matter of being able to explain these things in 5 or 10 seconds. But that doesn't mean that it's not worth pursuing. Stick around. We've got much more Cam and Company coming up next. We're spending some time with Butch Whiting from Cryptek. Butch, how are you, sir?
I'm good, thank you. How are you?
I'm excellent. And Jen Dolphin from Prefix, how are you, sir?
Good morning. I'm doing great, thanks.
And this is an absolute beautiful beast behind us right here. What are we looking at?
Well, this is a very special and unique project. This is the Cryptek Edition Dodge Ram Minotaur 1500. And it's an aftermarket vehicle that Prefix, Jan's company, has assembled in collaboration with Cryptek, the NRA, and several other great brands in the industry.
So this is, we as NRA members, we've got the opportunity to actually win this truck, right?
Well, there's going to be 150 of these trucks made, but this truck specifically, NRA members are going to be able to win. Not just the truck, but an absolute amazing package of gear from great brands such as Weatherby, Leupold, Springfield Armory, Tenzing, Boyd Harness, Wiley X, There's about $25,000 Nosler ammo. There's about $25,000 of additional outdoor gear that's going to come along with this truck. And some lucky NRA winner is going to, our member is actually going to be able to win this truck that's well over $100,000.
Golly, okay. We're gonna talk more about how folks can win this, but first, Jan, let's talk about what's involved in this actual Dodge Ram Minotaur. What makes it so different and special?
Oh, absolutely. So, just to clarify, Prefix, we're the company that builds most of the concept cars and prototypes for the auto industry. But every couple of years, we have a little fun. We find a vehicle that we think we could make better or enhance, or we think there's a niche market for. And so the Minotaur truck was built as an awesome daily driver. It's kind of built as the as an equivalent engineering-wise like a Baja race truck. So on the highway, it's fantastic. But it's got 14 inches of suspension travel. It's the real deal. You can jump this thing, and it is just a beast.
Well, as somebody who actually owns a Dodge Ram, I can tell you that my Dodge Ram 1500 looks nothing like this Dodge Ram. I'm drooling right now. I'm having to actually keep my mouth closed.
That's perfect.
And so, you talk about the suspension. What about under the hood? What are we looking at in terms of horsepower and?
Comes with the 5.7 Hemi, which is a great motor for this truck. We do offer an optional supercharger. Like I said, we're building 150 of these. It's very low volume production. We love that exclusivity because that means that there's a good chance that the guys that own them are going to be the only guys in town that have them. And as Butch said, then there's one lucky guy who's going to get not only to win a Minotaur truck, but it's also going to be loaded with the prize package. So this
we're going to be able to start entering this lottery or this raffle here early March, and this is going to run for a year, is that right?
That's my understanding. The NRA will really make an entire launch at the convention this year and open it up, and then all of the marketing and collateral start to go out and open up to NRA members. And then my understanding is that next year at the 2019 convention, they're going to pull a name out of a hat and somebody's going to win over $100,000 package.
I'm going to be entering. Are you going to be entering, Butch? Are you eligible? You're eligible, right?
I think so.
It's just a random drawing. All right.
If I won it, I'd turn it back in. That's always cool when that happens.
And re-raffle it.
Yeah.
Wow. That's a bold move for you, Butch.
Right.
I don't know that I'd be that generous, but this is amazing. And so tell me from your perspective, what was it like being involved in this project?
Well, it's kind of an interesting deal. When Prefix reached out to me and we started to have the discussion, hey, we'd like to talk to Cryptic about doing a Cryptic Edition Dodge Ram truck. You have to be like, first call's like, yeah, right, whatever, But then as we started the relationship and we started to understand what they were looking for and how this truck was a very, badass vehicle, and they felt that our brand nested well with the attitude of the truck.
He's being too nice. we knew we had done a lot of testing with these vehicles. We already had started selling them, and I was looking for something that we could do to really increase the excitement. And when we learned about Cryptic and their camo pattern, it was the attitude that this truck needed. It's exactly what it needed. So starting to work with Butch, kind of understanding the background of their company, Prefix is known, our tagline is excellence is expected, and we knew what we were putting into the vehicle. But to add this Cryptic attitude, very patriotic, very cutting edge, awesome, awesome look to the truck was just perfect. And we're getting the response because of it, for sure.
Well, for those who can't put down a deposit, we can buy a raffle ticket. NRABigTruckGiveaway.org. That's going to be the website that you need to go to enter this. Welcome back. Thanks again for being a part of today's Cam and Company right here on NRA TV, Sirius XM Patriot 125, and more. I want to welcome to the program the guy behind Instapundent.com, also a University of Tennessee law professor and a contributing columnist for USA Today. Mr. Glenn Reynolds is with us on the program. Glenn, how are you, sir?
Hi, it's great to be here.
It's good to talk with you. And I appreciate you joining us on the program today. I thought your column at USA Today was spot on, frankly, and I want to just quote, if I can, just a little bit. You say that shooting up schools has become an idea spread far and wide by saturation news coverage and more recently by social media as well. You say that now no kid has to think of shooting up a school on his or her own because the idea is inescapable, and every time another copycat shooting takes place, it becomes more so. And you note that
Going back to more than a decade ago, Lauren Coleman wrote The Copycat Effect, How the Media and Popular Culture Trigger the Mayhem in Tomorrow's Headlines. 2015, you say Malcolm Gladwell wrote a piece talking about school shootings in which he likened the spread of school shootings to a slow motion riot. He referred to this almost as a contagion, right? As a meme, not the cat memes, but how do you define a meme, Glenn?
Well, before people started calling funny pictures with captions on the internet memes, Richard Dawkins, who's a pretty famous geneticist, wrote a book called The Selfish Gene, and his point was that you are your gene's way of making more copies of themselves. There's self-replicating information. And then he said, there's other self-replicating information that just uses your brain to copy it. Ideas that spread in a viral way. And that includes everything from jokes that people want to tell to common religions and things like that. I think this is another example of that. 50 years ago, you had plenty of people with guns and plenty of people who were unhappy in schools, but they weren't shooting them up because there wasn't sort of a mental map for it. Now there's a model. I mean, these shooters, there are all these websites and chat groups for Columbine aficionados, and a lot of these shooters want to be stars, like the Columbine killers or other killers. They ape their style. They wear the clothes, like the trench coat that the Santa Fe kid wore. And they are, in essence, sort of taken over by this idea. And I think it's sort of like a virus, and you want to control it by doing some of the things you do to control the spread of viruses. You want to isolate it. You want to not keep infecting people with it. Which in this case is like, by not having media make such a big deal of every shooting and especially valorize every shooter, the way they make big stars of them. When the school shooting, with the worst case, that was when Rolling Stone put Zokhar Tsarnaev on the cover after the Boston Marathon bombers. But that's the kind of treatment that makes people want to be more. There's nothing bigger in American society today than being a celebrity. And when you make a celebrity out of these shooters, you just spread this idea everywhere.
And unfortunately, you're right. I mean, and you talk about Tsarnaev on the cover of Rolling Stone, but, by early Friday afternoon, that was the first question it seemed on everybody's, on the media's mind anyway, right? What's the suspect's name? Can we get the mugshot? What do we know about this individual? Before the names of the victims were even known, before we knew the first thing about any of those who had been killed or injured in this attack, we wanted to know who did it. What does this guy look like? What was the motivation behind this attack? And you've got the news stories, five things you need to know about the suspect. And you're right. At some point, and I know it's not the intent to glorify these individuals on the part of the media. But as you talk about the saturation coverage, and when, you're in wall-to-wall coverage and there's not a lot of new information coming around, when you get that mugshot, when you get that identity released, holy moly, you know that the media is going to, continue to flash that picture on the screen for hours to come. And you're right. There is a notoriety that inevitably comes from being one of these individuals. And you're saying that these individuals are now intentionally seeking out that notoriety.
Yeah. And in fact, seeking it out and copying each other. I mean, the copycat effect is a very good title, and it's gotten to where the school shooting thing is often almost ritualized. I mean, they shout out to each other in their final messages. It's almost like a kind of a sick fad in a way. I think that one of the things you want to do is not encourage that. And the other thing you want to do is give people resistance. I mean, you vaccinate people against viruses. The way you protect people against destructive ideas is to inculcate them with better ones. Now, schools have kind of quit trying to do that, really. I point out, and this is kind of odd coming from me. I'm a libertarian. I'm not a big religious guy. But 50 years ago, a lot of kids who thought about shooting up their school would have been afraid they'd go to hell. Now, people don't worry about that. They're not socialized to worry about that. They're certainly not socialized to worry about that in school. And as a result, if it's a choice between being a big celebrity and a star, or going off and killing yourself quietly because you're so miserable, what reason do you give them to choose the latter rather than the former?
Yeah, there is there's a nihilist strain, particularly in this subculture that you talk about that has sort of sprung up around these mass killers. And you write in your column, you say college professor Kay Hogard, who has for years taught Shirley Jackson's story, The Lottery. And most everybody read this in high school, right? It's the once a year the town people gather and they pick up stones and they end up killing somebody. She wrote recently that she's seen a change in how her students are responding to this story. Whereas again, they used to react with horror, like, oh my God, I never saw that twist coming. I can't believe this. And now, maybe it's just the culture there, right? They stone people to death once a year. So who are we to judge?
Yeah, she said she had a class of 30 students last year and she couldn't get any of them to condemn it. None of them would say definitively that, oh, that's wrong to stone somebody at random every year. They're all just like, well, if it's a part of their culture, who are we to judge? And, you know, if you can't get students to agree that human sacrifice is wrong, how do you convince them that killing their classmates is wrong? I mean, what values do you give them to offset the fact that, hey, they can be a celebrity? Look, these loser shooters all get a lot of emails. No women want them until they kill a bunch of people. Then they get all these emails from girls who think they're great. You have to have something to offset that. If there's nothing in life but celebrity and notoriety, then people are willing to do pretty much anything for celebrity and notoriety.
You know, and that's the thing. And I agree with you, but you talk about being a libertarian. Like, that's not something you can address via legislation. You can't come up with a law that's all of a sudden gonna, you know, restore the values of virtue and developing a thick skin and being able to handle rejection and, you know, being able to handle the crappy years of high school. I mean, you can't legislate your way out of nihilism. I don't think you can anyway.
I think the trouble is it's a lot easier to break down a culture than it is to build it back up, and particularly at the legal level. And I think that's unfortunately some of the stuff we've done. As a libertarian, I will say one of the things I've concluded as I get older is that libertarians focus too much on economics and don't put enough weight into the importance of culture. And maybe it's because I was an anthropology minor in college, but I actually think culture matters.
I do too. Andrew Breitbart famously said politics is downstream from culture, and I would agree with that. And and it's interesting that again, there's no shortage of cultural figures out there today, Glenn, that are demanding, you hand over your guns. We need quote unquote common sense gun regulations, and at the same time, not only are they a part of that culture of celebrity, they depend on that culture of celebrity that you talk about.
Yeah, and I think we need to go back to the old Roman view in which actors and celebrities generally were considered sort of suspect second-class citizens who should receive little respect and less attention outside of their professional roles. I think the Romans knew what they were doing there. We should really emulate that.
Talking again with Glenn Reynolds from Instapundit.com. Now, did I understand correctly? Is that shirt that you're wearing, Glenn, is that a veterans charity that you've got?
Oh, yeah, this is this is Vols for Vets. It's cool. It's a student organization at the University of Tennessee College of Law, organized by a mixture of, we have a lot of veterans among our students. It's a mixture of them and some non-veterans, and it supports veterans in a variety of ways on campus and also military dependents. And I gave them some money this year, so they gave me a shirt.
That's awesome. Okay, what's the name of the organization again? Balls for Veterans?
Balls, VOLS, as in volunteers, because we're the Tennessee Volunteers.
Okay, I was like,
for Balls.
Okay, that makes way more sense there, coming from the University of Tennessee. I was thinking, I thought I knew all of the veterans charities, but I didn't realize that there was one focusing on, footballs and basketballs for veterans. But there you go. Vols for Veterans. Glenn Reynolds, a law professor at UT in Knoxville. And Glenn, we've just got a minute or two left. I've got to ask you, I mean, when you see these calls for, the standard gun control, universal background checks, let's ban these semi-automatic firearms. Senator Chris Murphy of Connecticut saying that basically Congress is condoning these types of attacks by not passing gun control legislation when none of those proposals would have actually stopped this attack. Do you have any confidence that we can get beyond the stale debate over, well, let's ban these guns, let's repeal the Second Amendment, and actually get to some of these tougher, I don't want to say esoteric, but maybe tougher philosophical issues that you bring up in your column?
I don't know. I mean, I try not to write the same thing everybody else is writing for this column. I write once a week for USA Today, and I try not to just sort of pile on whatever's going on. I try to find a different angle when I can. But I have to say, in the bigger picture, I'm a little pessimistic. The reason for gun control on the part of America's elite is not to accomplish any particular public safety end. It's mostly to keep the flyover people in their place, and it's mostly attractive because it is seen as humiliating and degrading to the flyover people to subject them to a policy that they really, really don't like. And that's what the elite in America, I think, actually want. They want to ram it down people's throats to show them who's in charge. And the more insecure they get about who's in charge, the bigger and more emotionally invested deal this becomes to them.
Yeah, that's actually that's a really, really good insight. I appreciate you coming on the program, sir. I hope we get a chance to do this again very soon.
Thanks for having me. Always a pleasure.
Yeah, my pleasure. Glenn Reynolds, Instapundit, and Instapundit on Twitter, instapundit.com. And again, what Glenn said, I think, is really, really important. You know, we've talked about this with Charles Cook this afternoon. The calls for more gun control laws when, and again, sort of vague calls by Senator Murphy, but chastising Congress for not acting, even though none of the proposals that Chris Murphy has brought forth as a senator would have stopped this attack on Friday. Governor Martin O'Malley, former governor of Maryland, signing the Maryland Firearm Safety Act in early 2013. And then when the homicide rate rose exponentially in Baltimore, Maryland, in 2015 and 2016 and 2017, three straight years of 300-plus homicides, nobody, no supporter of that legislation, publicly said, you know what, we should go back and actually try to figure out why this didn't bring down the homicide rate in Baltimore. They never want to look back at the gun control policies that they put in place when they failed. But they do want to defend them, right? I mean, you could look at the Heller decision. In 1976, D.C. City Council passes a handgun ban. It goes into effect in 1977. Almost immediately, the violent crime rate starts to rise in Washington, D.C. And yet, by 2008, when there was clear evidence that this ban did nothing to protect citizens in Washington, D.C., you did not have a single purveyor of quote-unquote common sense gun safety legislation who would dare to come out and say, yeah, you know what, that gun ban, that went too far. And it didn't work. It was ineffective. And I'm just in favor of these common sense solutions, so we got to reject this gun ban. No. They wanted that ban in place. Every single gun control group arguing that you don't have a right to keep and bear arms. You've got a right to join a militia. And then if you want to keep and bear arms, you can join a militia and you can bear arms there. But not one of those anti-gun groups, which now, of course, all swear fealty to your right to keep and bear arms. None of them actually agreed or thought that that right even existed. But they don't want to go back and revisit the failures. They just want to keep pushing for more and more of the same. All right, that music means we've got to scoot. We'll be back tomorrow, live, 2 p.m. Eastern, 9 Pacific. Midnight Eastern on SiriusXM Patriot 125 with more of the day's top stories. Thanks again for tuning in to Monday's Cam and Company.